On with Bob Kincaid. 3 hours of conversation cussing and a discussing with America's only born and bred Southern liberal talk host. Head On with Bob Kincaid is brought to you each night by Coal River Mountain Watch. Coal River Mountain Watch invites you to become part of the solution, part of a sustainable future, part of the uprising against mountaintop removal. Coal River Mountain Watch, CRMW.net. And now, from high in the hills of beautiful West Bicod, Virginia, here's Bob Kincaid on the Head On Radio Network.
Well, howdy! Welcome, welcome, one and all, to this Thursday evening edition of Head On. I am Bob Kincaid. You know that, of course. And rather than me jumping out there and commenting on the day's news, I want to go straight to a conversation which I have promised you in the foregoing days. A conversation I think you will find as engaging and thought-provoking as any that have been on this program in recent memory. It concerns education. And you know how much education means to me. I come from a long line of educators. My sainted grandmother taught public school in right here in Fayette County, West Virginia, for 60 years. At one point in time, she was voted the best one-room school teacher in West Virginia. Mom and Dad both graduated in the class of 1943 from Anstead High School. My sister's a teacher. My aunts are teachers. Education runs in my blood, frankly. And on the line with us, former West Virginia governor and president now of the Alliance for Excellent Education and author of a new book, Raising the Grade, my former congressman as well as my former governor, Bob Wise. Governor, thank you for taking time out to talk with us and welcome to the program.
Oh, Bob, great to hear from you and also to be on the program. And I really appreciate your interest in this and talking about what I think is one of the most important issues, if not the most important, for not only our state but also our nation.
Well, Governor, it was probably a month or so ago on this program that I had a news story that said something on the order of we have, a high school dropout rate in this country that is measured in millions every year. And I just sat in sort of slack-jawed wonder behind the microphone, contemplating what a snowballing disaster we're creating for ourselves. You've addressed that in this book, have you not?
Yes, I have. In fact, that's what motivated me to write the book, Raising the Grade, How High School Reform Can Save Our Youth and Our Nation. Well, let's just take it one day. This was a school day across the country. Most schools have let out by now across the country, and 7,000 children disappeared today. When I say disappeared, they dropped out of high school. They do that each and every school day. It's a total of well over 1 million a year. In West Virginia, we'll lose 6,700 to 7,000 students last year did not graduate. And so you can see it. To me, it's almost a third. It's 30% of our kids who start the ninth grade will not finish high school, and another third, Bob, will not finish either college ready or ready for the modern workplace. So what that means is that two out of three of our children across the country who start school in the ninth grade will not finish their high school years with what they need to be able to function fully in our modern economy.
That's bone chilling.
It should be to all of us, because it's not only about their future and everyone who drops out. I mean, I can quote you chapter and verse of statistics on they're far less like they're 50% likely to be employed. That's about the best shot they've got. They'll be working at far less wages. But there's another group that's directly affected too, and that's the rest of us, because these are now citizens that aren't going to be able to participate fully in the U.S. economy, not going to be able to, it's very threatening as far as the future workforces, our ability to remain globally competitive, you name it.
Now, I'm a liberal. I'm a hardcore progressive liberal, whatever word you like to attach to it. And I'm also a parent, Governor, and I've seen basically the mess that No Child's No Child Left Behind. I have a smart alecky name for it that I won't use in this conversation. But I've seen what kind of an impact that's had here in my small community and around West Virginia. Where is it, do you think, and based on your research and what you've written in the book, where is it first and foremost that we're going wrong?
Well, I think first and foremost is we haven't really kept up with what it is that our high schools of the 21st century should look like. You mentioned your long line of educators in your family, and I happen to believe that most educators are doing an excellent job and actually producing far more than we should reasonably expect given what we're asking them to teach in. But we have a high school model that was basically designed in the 19th century that's still virtually unchanged in the 21st. And yet we have greatly increased skill needs. We have a generation of young people that get their information in a lot more places, a lot more technologically oriented places than you and I did, for instance. And so where are we going wrong is that we have, as we have upgraded our workplace skills, as our traditional industries now operate on much different basis than they did years ago, as we have new industries and new businesses, we haven't kept our education system, and particularly our high schools, up. And you mentioned No Child Left Behind. However people feel about NCLB, love it, hate it, whatever, No Child Left Behind doesn't deal with high schools. And indeed, the support and the sanctions of high school that No Child Left Behind is supposed to bring, the help that No Child Left Behind, is based upon whether or not you get federal funding. Well, only 8% of high school students are covered by basic federal funding, the Title I program. Effectively, then, No Child Left Behind doesn't help high schools.
That's an amazing number. I had no idea, Governor. So what then would you like to see as far as federal intervention in the high school education process? Do you have a priority list?
I do have a priority list. You didn't think I'd get on the show with that one. My priority list is, first of all, for the federal government to recognize middle and high schools are an important piece of the total education continuum or pipeline. Right now, the federal government spends about $18 billion a year supporting, as rightly it should, I don't want one penny taken from it, supporting pre-K to grade six. It spends, so think of that one side of the, what I call the bookends, like goalposts on a football field. So you've got one goalpost, one side up. The other side is higher education. The federal government spends about $16 billion in direct student assistance, Pell Grants, and so on. So now imagine those two posts that are standing up there. So where's the crossbar? Well, the crossbar is middle and high schools. Unfortunately, they're only funded to $2.3 and $2.5 billion. So now you've got $18 billion pre-K to 6, you've got $16 billion higher ed, and yet the crossbar is only less than $3 billion for each one. And incidentally, that's where we see the trail off in educational performance in our, both in West Virginia but also nationally, in those years. So first thing I'd like to do is to see the federal government understand that middle and high schools need attention too. Second thing I'd like to see the federal government do is then target money to school districts and to states that have developed plans for turning around the lowest performing high schools. We have in our nation, we have roughly somewhere, depending on whom you talk to, let's say around 17,000 high schools. We have 2,000 of them that contribute half the dropouts. Remember that 1.2 million
Yes.
figure of dropouts? Well, half of them, 2,000 schools, about 12 to 14% of the high schools in the country, contribute half the dropouts. So we know where the so-called dropout factories are. So let's target those for immediate work and turning them around. And then let's focus on the next group up that graduate between 60 and 70%. That's another 1,800 high schools out of the 17,000. So we know where they are, too. So now we've already dealt with somewhere around 60% of the dropouts in this country. And you mentioned some people say, well, okay, so you just want to throw money at the problem. Two things. One is I'm not interested in spending money just to make a bad system more expensive. But the second thing is, let's talk about return on investment. If you, a recent very credible economic study showed that if you could cut the number of dropouts in this country in half, the federal government alone would see $45 billion more in increased tax revenues and cost savings. $45 billion a year. Now, everybody, think about the economic stimulus package. Everybody's getting a check for $600. run out, buy a sweater, or buy gasoline, I guess, pay off your Visa bill. But yet, for $5 billion a year, if I could cut the cost of, I could cut the dropouts in half, and I could create $45 billion in new tax revenues for the federal government because more people are working and paying taxes and so on. Isn't that the? And so, to me, the real economic stimulus package is a diploma.
Absolutely, and you mentioned that $5 billion number. I can't help but, for me and what I do on this program, Governor, I try to sort of draw lines between things that look like they wouldn't naturally have lines drawn between them. And last night we had a story about an Air Force program where the Air Force wants to spend $30 billion over 5 years to develop what they call cyberspace command with hacker contractors. Now, if we've got $6 billion a year to pay hackers, surely to goodness we can find $5 billion a year to create the 45 billion you just mentioned in new tax revenue from and it's not just new tax revenue, it's people having a meaningful life.
Absolutely.
In this
Absolutely.
Country. I forget who the philosopher was who said that most men lead lives of quiet desperation. But that's not a 21st century model, and it's not a 20th or 19th or 18th century American value, you know, is it?
No. You bring up something else. It used to be that you would argue for better education. There were two groups that would argue from different points of view. One was the civil rights, what I call the imperatives, civil rights imperative, because every child should have a quality education. And that was based on, and that's the first place you start, a moral belief. The second, though, was the economic argument, saying, listen, our economy will be much better because we have a higher, more highly educated workforce. The two never hooked up before. Well, today, they are. They're inextricable. They're joined because you can't. It used to be. I know that when I graduated from high school in West Virginia in 1966, I didn't need a high school diploma to go work in the coal mines, the steel mills, or the chemical plants that were around our area. Today, I would need some kind of community college to go to work in any of them. I need post-secondary. So what's happened in our society is we need every child, black, brown, white, we need every child educated to the fullest of their potential to, in order for our economy to be able to thrive. Think of the higher skill levels in all the jobs that we've always known in West Virginia, the traditional occupations, plus the new kinds of occupations that are emerging.
Indeed. Now, I assume, however, that you don't want to throw the baby out with the bathwater. Because there, I mentioned my mom and dad graduating in 1943 from Anstead High School. When they graduated, Governor, they had been schooled in biology, they had been schooled in chemistry, they had had Latin, journalism, theater, speech, English, mathematics, algebra, and this is just a little country high school, up Route 60. What do we do about disparity of content in the educational experience? Because certainly a kid going to school in a wealthy school district in, say, Connecticut gets a vastly different educational experience than, say, my daughter who's going to enter ninth grade next year up the road here at Midland Trail High School. Is there any way to level the playing field content-wise?
Well, we have to. Too often the playing field, it's not on the content. I mean, that's what plays out, but it's the funding disparities. And if every state, including West Virginia, traditionally based its educational funding on the property tax. So if you were from an area that had a wealthier base, then your schools tended to be better. West Virginia actually has been one of the leaders in the country in equalizing that spending. And so, it used to be that 75% of all dollars spent in West Virginia in education came from property tax, 25% came from the state. It's now reversed. And so the first is equality of funding. The second, then, is to make sure that we are able to deliver that content, whether it's by having that trained teacher. The best thing, of course, is the teacher actually in the classroom, but are there other means in some cases in our rural schools where we're going to have to use technology, whether it's internet or web-based learning or virtual learning or whatever, to make sure that that quality education is there. But we have to guarantee that every child, wherever they live, whether it's Boise, Idaho to Brooklyn, we have to remember something. First of all, they're not competing with one another anymore. They're competing with the children in Bangalore and Beijing and Berlin. and they're going to have skill levels equal. It's funny, it's not Boone County versus Raleigh County, whose standards are tougher. We're all being measured today against the standard in Singapore. And so that's why it's going to be critical that we say to our children and to our parents, wherever you go to school, we have to make sure that you have exactly what you mentioned earlier, a rigorous curriculum. We have, one of the things my organization's done is develop the 10 elements of a successful high school. And so we urge people to, and all of this, incidentally, Bob, is on our website. You either Google Alliance for Excellent Education or go to www.allall4ed.org.
I'm looking at it right now.
We have the 10 elements of a successful high school. Incidentally, we also have everything I've talked about here, but we have information state by state. What's the economic impact of the fact that a state has a certain number of dropouts? We have a state card for every state, including West Virginia. West Virginia, the young people that did not graduate last year in the state of West Virginia will cost over their working lifetime, it will cost almost $1.7 billion in lost income to West Virginia. And so you can go and get a picture. That's why it is so critical that we recognize that every child needs to have that curriculum that you're talking about and the opportunity to access it. One thing I do want to stress in my book, and I say this in the book, but I want to stress it on the show, is I'm not here to simply talk about a dire situation. There are some schools that are doing a wonderful job. Kids are getting a great opportunity, a great education. There are some schools that are doing a mediocre job, and there's some that are doing a terrible job. What I want to stress is there is a crisis for many of our high schools. We know what to do about it. We have to have the will, and that's why I wrote the book, was to build the will to take care of it, for people to address this. And in West Virginia, I want to say that there's some positive things happening. The governor and the state board of education have been working on recognizing that the workforce development is tied closely to the quality of education. And so what is it that we need for the workforce, West Virginia needs for the workforce of the future? I appreciate the fact that the State Board of Education has taken a hard look at high schools. When I was in office, unfortunately, there were some numbers, statistics out there that were too rosy. I didn't realize it until I left office. They took a hard look and said, you know, we're not graduating as many as we thought we are, and we've got to do something about it. I don't want to leave the impression, and also the statistics that we have on our website. If somebody goes and says, okay, well, West Virginia, this seems to be low. Remember, every state, unfortunately, that's the story in my book. Every state has this problem. Differing degrees in different states. Every state has it, but we have to have the will to address it.
What about something like
that? I think there's a strong federal piece here, too, because it used to be that education strictly at the local and state levels, mainly at the local level. But that young person that joins the military, or that young person who goes to work for a large company, whether it's Microsoft or an industrial company or whatever, they're not, when you join the military, they don't train you according to whether or not you come from Texas or you come from Illinois or North Dakota. They expect you to know wherever you're being trained, you have to learn what they need you to know. Well, it's the same thing in education, and so that's why the federal government increasingly has a role to make sure that every student in our nation has the opportunity to thrive to the maximum of their ability.
And, you know, something you just said, Governor, just sort of struck a chord with me. In a way, your remarks are rather reminiscent to me of Al Gore. It seems like you and he both share something in common in that once you stepped back from long careers in government service and looked back at what you had experienced and what you'd accomplished, you saw a completely different picture, didn't you?
Yes, and in fact, I opened my book with that. I wish I had known 10 years ago what I've learned in the last three as head of the Alliance for Excellent Education. And so you're absolutely correct. You are able to step back. I hope that I think that the people that I worked with and we left things better for education than they had been. I'm proud of the fact of signing the legislation in West Virginia that Senator Jackson created and others that created a program for four-year-olds. I'm proud of standing up for Head Start in the Congress. I'm proud of the Promise Scholarship and some of the work on providing access to young people to be able to go on to college. But you know something? I missed the middle. And I should have been spending as much time focusing on middle and high schools. And I found, as I did research for this book, I look across the country and I see there are a whole bunch of other folks missing the middle, too.
Where is the shortfall beyond the dollar figures that we've talked about, Governor? Where is the philosophical or curricular shortfall, especially in those middle school years and moving into high school?
I'm not an educator, but my observation is this, because I think it's a mistake that maybe we made in policy. We believed, particularly coming out of the 1960s, but we believe that if you give children a strong foundation, in other words, you focus on the early grades, early childhood, that once you got through the, say, fourth to fifth, sixth grades, that you gave them a strong foundation, they could take it from there. And that's not the case. What we've learned and what research now shows is that it's critical that they have that early foundation, Head Start programs, early child development, reading initiatives, and so on. But you can't think that that's where you can stop. It's like me. I'm not a carpenter. You can build my foundation, but I'm going to need help finishing the house. So what we would do is we put a lot of effort, rightly so, into early years, but we didn't put the same amount of effort, dollar support, into the middle and high school years. Second thing is, a child, what I have learned, and educators can tell us, is that a child, a young person in middle and high school, is learning differently than obviously than a child in grade school and kindergarten. So we have to have strategies that are tailored to that. And recognize something else, a statistic that I was amazed to learn. I never appreciated this until the last few years. According to the only federal test that's given, National Assessment of Education Progress, it's the only way we have to measure state by state how kids are stacking up. Eighth graders' reading ability, in the eighth grade, 70% of our eighth graders test below proficient, according to the federal benchmark. Now, let's think what that means is that means they're reading below grade level. There's 30% are reading two or three grades below grade level. So now they're entering high school, the toughest courses, and there they don't expect to teach you to read. They expect you to be able to absorb the material out of the chemistry book, the science book, the English book, and turn it into coherent thoughts. Now they're entering high school, and they can't read and comprehend at their grade level. That's why you have two-thirds of your dropouts taking place in ninth and tenth grade. So literacy effort at all stages of a child's education, not stopping at third grade, is critical.
From a legislative standpoint, you dropping out plays a big part in what we're discussing here. There were steps taken here in West Virginia to try to curb the dropout rate, for instance, relating to driver's licenses and things like that. But and you've obviously got access to far better data than I do. We allow children to legally drop out of the educational system at an age when science now knows that their brain isn't anywhere near fully developed, when they're not legally liable within the judicial system. They can't vote. It seems like the only right that we give someone under the 18 years of age is to shoot themselves in the foot and quit school. Is there anything that can be done legislatively, do you think, in that regard?
Well, a number of states. West Virginia, as you point out, was one of the leaders in tying the driver's license to being in high school. And that I think, probably had some impact. A number of states have taken up and passed legislation saying at least you have to be 18. But I want to stress that I think it's important, and like you point out, that's a message to send, but it's also important to make sure that the educational experience is something that kids see as relevant and causes them to want to stay in school. So that means that going back to making sure that those courses are, that they see the relevance to them, that they're engaging. And it also means something else. And you talked about that small high school that your parents or your relatives have gone to. Small is not necessarily automatically always good, but what is important about a small school is that it's a personalized experience. And so that even if you have a large high school, 1,000, 1,500 kids, then that school we need to make sure that every student in that school has a direct relationship with at least one adult on a regular basis. Many schools have restructured themselves so that while you still have kids going to different classes, you have an adult that's directly responsible for checking in with 15 to 20 students every week. And in turn, every teacher in that school that has that student sends a report, an email or a report to that court, to that adult, on how that student's doing. Now that student isn't lost. Think of the poor guidance counselor, 500 students, in many cases. Now think of the poor teacher who has 120 to 150 students a day. They can't spend time on the kids that need it the most. And so that's why it's important to structure that school so that there is somebody that student is looking to for assistance and advice on a regular basis.
And I can't imagine what it would be like to be a middle or high school teacher, Governor, because of what we see in pay scales around the country. You're talking about you're talking about people who are literally the future's first responders, if you will. Within the funding structures that you've described, and that paucity, that 8% of Title I funding that you mentioned earlier, is there a recognition that we have to both philosophically and economically recognize what a tremendous job teachers face in this country?
Well, they face a great challenge, and they face it not only in the educational world, but they also face it because a lot of students don't come to them under the most ideal circumstances. That school door opens at 7:30 in the morning, and that student walks in, and the teacher is then contending with, does that student come from an abusive family situation? Does the student come from a one-parent household where the parent is working two or three jobs and not able to be involved in that student's life as much as he or she would like to be? I mean, is that student coming to them in an impoverished situation? Does that student have health needs that hasn't been able to get signed up for FCHIP, a program for children, or Medicaid? So that's why I say it. I happen to believe, people say, well, who's to blame, Bob? I happen to think everyone is working under incredible conditions and actually producing far more than what the system was ever designed for. The only trouble is we're working with an old system. I used to, in my book, I talk about the 1965 Chevy convertible I used to drive my dad had when I was in high school. I bought that car when I was in the governor's mansion. I bought that car, found it, bought it back, fixed it up, spent far too much money. And you know something? That car would do exactly, after I spent all that money, would do exactly what it had been designed to do, run 60 miles an hour all day on the West Virginia Turnpike. That's not what it's supposed to do nowadays. It didn't have safety equipment. It didn't have a modern engine. It burned unleaded fuel, or burned leaded fuel. And on top of that, it didn't even have cup holders. And so so we have high schools, a high school model designed for when we only needed 50 or 60% of our kids to graduate and only a handful of them to go on to college, in a society where today we need, all of our kids graduating, and we need, 70 to 80% going on to college or some kind of post-secondary experience. And let me just say, the difference between when I was going to high school 40 or 50 years ago almost now in West Virginia and today is, today 90% of the fastest growing high-paying jobs and 60% of current jobs require education after high school. That wasn't the situation when I was in high school. You didn't need a high school diploma, or you needed just a high school diploma and you could get a good high-paying job.
And that is dramatically different now. Another dramatic difference that strikes me is the high school education experience that you had and the experience that I mentioned with my parents and their friends and their community was in an America where most children were getting up in the morning, going to school. They had I'm just talking demographically. There was most of the time a stay-at-home mom and a go-to-work dad. This is a radically different America, Governor. How do we? Is it possible in the structures that you're describing in Raising the Grade? Is it possible to address in the academic educational environment some of those factors that you just mentioned about how the home life has changed?
The home life has changed, but what we have to do is to recognize. But so much else has changed too. I needed to get a message to my daughter the other day. In the old days, I would have called the school and seen it. Hopefully somebody would have carried it to the homeroom and so on. I texted her on her cell phone. look at how you and I derive a lot of our information. I wanted to learn more about your radio network, so I didn't go to look in the library. I went online. And so the home life has changed, but so has society. And in our, we have to make sure that our schools reflect that. A lot of our kids aren't going to look to the high school to give them their the relevance they want about if they make the decision whether or not to stay in school. That's why good career and technical education is so critical through community colleges, so kids see the relevance. And finally, I agree with you, and I feel very fortunate in when I was growing up in the kind of traditional family life. But, you know, as I look back, I don't think a lot of kids had that. We just didn't know it.
Well, that's possible, too. Yes, absolutely.
And I look back, and I talk about this in my book, is I look back now, and I recognized, and I recognized it at the time, but there was sharp divisions in my high school. This was in Kanawha County. But there was a group of kids that were middle to upper income, and there was a group, they merged two schools into one, and there was a group that was low income. And in those days, 40 or 50 years ago, you got tracked, and you got sent off to either vocational program or college prep. Well, today, what the research is very clear on, and what educators increasingly tell us, is the needs are much the same. The young person that doesn't intend to go to college, at least immediately, but wants to go right into the workforce, they need much of the same coursework that for the kid that wants to go to college. And so we have to understand that the needs and demands of our society have changed, and we have to adopt systems that can accommodate that. I don't think we're going to get back. I'd love to see the day when we could depend upon more firmly established families, a whole lot of things. I don't think we're going to get back to that. But what we have to do is to meet kids as they come in the door, assess their needs, and then make sure they get the best quality education possible.
Well, Governor, there are very good tools and a ton of information on the Alliance for Excellent Education's website, and you and the organization are to be highly commended for putting it out there. I can only say that I know for a fact that there is a ton of thought-provoking information within the four corners of Raising the Grade as well. Can I assume that your organization will also be taking affirmative steps to press for legislation inside the Congress?
Yes, in fact, that's why we were created in 2001. I've been with the Alliance, obviously, since leaving office in West Virginia since 2005. But that's why we exist, is to try and inform the federal Congress and to press for an increased federal role in high school reform. We were created and we're funded by a number of foundations. And incidentally, any profits from the book do not go to me. They go to the Alliance for Excellent Education. But we were funded to do nothing but make sure that the federal government was meaningfully participating in reforming high schools.
Well, I ask you that question because with regard to the listening audience that is, in fact, national, is there a little bit of door rattling that they can begin to do as far as their elected representatives are concerned once they've availed themselves of the information?
The No Child Left Behind law expires this year, but because Congress isn't going to act, most likely will not act on it, it stays in effect for the next, well, until Congress does act. So it's going to stay with us. But Congress can still pass legislation that improves high schools, and there's something called the Graduation Promise Act. They would target funds to the lowest performing high schools that develop a plan for turning themselves around. There's other legislation that's all on our website, as a matter of fact, that's in Congress and indeed has good bipartisan support. Republicans and Democrats alike have agreed that high schools need work. The question is whether there's the will, the political will. So contacting that member of Congress, and the reason we created our website state by state is to give people information that they can use in their state talking to their member of Congress.
Well, I tell you what, like I said, it's a fascinating book that, and obviously it's just made my head spin because I do spend a lot of time thinking about these things, and I wish you the absolute best. I know that there's some hot button stuff out there that has wedge issues to it that's hard to deal with. But you've gotten your thumb on the pulse beat of what I think is the biggest part of the problem, and that's just keeping the kids in school in the first place. And I wish you the very best. And it's been a pleasure having you both as my congressman and as my governor in the past. And I wish you all the very best, Governor Wise.
Well, Bob, thank you, and thank you very, very much for your interest in this. And if we can supply you or any of your listeners additional information, either go to the website or just email us.
All right.
Contact.
We absolutely will, and I'll produce a copy of this recording, and I'll make it available to y'all there for your use any way you'd like.
We'd really appreciate that. We'll put it on our website.
Great. Well, thank you very much, Governor, and thank you for taking time at the end of your day to have this conversation with us.
Well, thank you. You know, if you and I work hard enough, then maybe at the end of another day, there won't have been 7,000 kids that disappeared.
I'd like to cut that to zero.
Yep.
All right. Thank you, Governor.
Yeah. Thanks, Bob.
Bye now. Governor and Congressman, former Congressman Bob Wise, my former governor, my former congressman, and a real gentleman. In terms of having a conversation, and I like what he has done since exiting public service, turning towards something as critical as education. Can you imagine 7,000 kids? Those of you who have kids, those of you who have been kids, hey, there's a bigger group. Imagine 7,000 kids a day just gone. Not dead, just disappeared. Just cast into a lane that leads to a tragic future. I encourage you to get your hands on the book, Raising the Grade, How High School Reform Can Save Our Youth and Our Nation. It is a production of Governor Wise and the Alliance for Excellent Education. The website really is loaded with great stuff. The High Schools in Your State tool that is down the right-hand side of the page, it has information on every state. Click on it, find out stuff that you probably didn't know in the first place, and then act on it. The website is ALL, the numeral 4, ALL4ED. allfored.org. And, well, he's right. We're not measured, you know, it's not Texas against Delaware or anything. We are measured against places like India now. And you know what? We are found wanting. We're found wanting in mathematics and science skills. We're found wanting in language skills. Some newspaper writing and some legal research is already being farmed out to India, thanks to the miracle of the Internet. Cost less, and you get the work in the same amount of time as a brick-and-mortar operation. We have to be ready for that now, don't we? So that's the beginning of the program. It is far from the end. We've got a ton of information out there. Of course, Mark Levine spent the hour talking about the California court decision today. That's big news. I hope it sticks. For the sake of the American people and for the sake of the Constitution of the United States, I hope it sticks. But there's other stuff as well. And there's stuff that's not going to make you terribly happy. You probably already know about it. Stuff that's making me just a little bit crazy. And we will we'll deal with all of it. We'll take also as much time as needed for your conversations. You know the phone number, 304-658-3333. Or toll-free, 877-443-2366. Either way is fine by me. This is Conversation Radio on America's listener-supported liberal voice. This is The Horn.
The mama pajama rolled out of bed and she ran to the police station. When the papa found out, he began to shout and started the investigation. It's against the law. It was against the law. What the mama saw, It was against the law. Your mama looked down and spit on the ground every time her name gets mentioned. The papa said, oh, if I get that boy, I'm gonna stick him in the house of detention. Well, I'm on my way. I don't know where I'm going. I'm on my way. I'm taking my time, but I don't know where. Goodbye to Rose, the queen of Corona. See me and Julio down by the schoolyard. See me and Julio down by the schoolyard. Take me away, but the press let the story leak. Now when the radical preachers come to get me released, we is all on the cover of Newsweek. And I'm on my way. I don't know where I'm going. I'm on my way. I'm taking my time, but I don't know where. Goodbye to Rose, the queen of Corona. See me and Julio down by the schoolyard. See me and Julio down by the schoolyard. See me and Julio down by the schoolyard.
All right, 19 minutes before the hour, and we'll shift gears now and move on to the topics of the evening. We will go first to the phone, however. Our good buddy Ed is calling in. Hey, Ed, welcome to the program.
Thanks a lot, Bob.
How are you?
I'm doing pretty good. I haven't been listening to the first party program, so I don't know what your agenda was. But I had a, you know, I've listened to the news, you know, and two or three programs has covered this. You know, this hassle, I don't know if any of them will do anything about it, but they argue over how the negotiations should go with Iran and these other countries. And the United States has got the gall to try to say that it, in other words, they put the conditions out there that you're going to do this and you're going to do that before they ever get into negotiations. That's not what the negotiations is about. If a union goes in and says, well, we're not negotiating unless you do that, that ain't negotiations at all.
That's an ultimatum, last I checked.
Yeah. And how are we ever, and that damned idiot, Bush, I'm telling you, he, you wouldn't think you could be any more tanked out of him than what you already are. But he is so disgusting that I'm flabbergasted by him, absolutely. And I'm not one of the intelligent people that you talk to. But a danged idiot can see what, see through him. And then to set and put preconditions why we're not going to negotiate with them, you go into negotiations with an open door. Now you have something in mind you're after. But when you get in there is when you start putting conditions and seeing if you can't trade and make things right. But when you are at an impasse before you even get into negotiations, that is not negotiations. It's disgusting. And McCain, Bob, I'll make you another bet and give you a chance to get even with your coat.
All right.
I'll bet you that if he gets 35 to 38% of the total vote, that it'll be a miracle. That's how disgusted, and you know, I know you talk to very intelligent people, and they contribute a lot, they know a lot, but I think you are scared to death that McCain will get in, and you've got plenty of room to be, but
I don't think anybody ever went broke underestimating the American voter, Ed.
I know they're well, West Virginians are hillbillies, but those people are beyond that. You know, I'm one of the hillbillies, but
so am I. I mean, you know, no, that's not my. I'm talking about people all over this country.
That's what I'm talking about. We are behind times, but compared to the people that put George Bush and people like that in office, it's just indescribable to me. I can't get a handle on where reasoning and common sense and can't. To me, it's like drawing a picture on a bear on a blackboard and calling it a deer.
Well, that's what a lot of voters do. I mean, did you happen to see the news footage of the people coming out of the? And I'm talking about West Virginia and just West Virginia. People coming out of the election, out of the polling places, and telling people on camera that they voted that they couldn't vote for Obama because he's a Muslim and wants to take the oath of office on the Quran.
I've heard worse than that on him.
I saw that. You know, and it's all a lie that has been put out there, and with some people it sticks.
Yeah. Well, they can say all that stuff they want to, but these two candidates are so dang near even on ideas and moving America ahead that I can support either one of them in the. They're not
in November,
choice.
Yeah.
My choice got 7% of the vote.
Yeah, John Edwards.
You're right. And but since we're stuck with one of these people, then whichever one comes out, I'm just like you are. I'm gonna put everything I got behind it. I guarantee you I can get them 150 votes. That don't sound like very much.
Ed, come on, don't sell yourself short, buddy. That sounds like a ton. If everybody in America who was committed to having to saving this nation would guarantee the Democratic nominee 150 votes, McCain wouldn't get 3%.
I know that many people to call. I know that many people that listen, you know, when I call in on both of the programs that know me well enough, they call me. You know, I get calls at home on the comments I make and the common sense approach, and still yet a lot of the union guys that I worked with and remember my leadership there, they will go along. They trust what I say. It's just that simple.
And you know what we do? I do. I'm not going to include you. I do a lot of complaining about our elected representatives, Ed, but you know what? I got to give them credit, and I think we have to give them credit when they get things right.
When is it?
Well, it happened today.
What, on what?
The House of Representatives stopped it dead in its tracks, $163 billion blank check for Iraq for the occupation.
Well, hallelujah.
Guess what?
Yeah. I didn't hear that.
I
haven't had the news on a lot. I just turned it on.
Well, I'm sure it won't get much coverage, especially if you know, Britney Spears has broken a nail or Lindsay Lohan tripped over a fire hydrant or something.
And then by the time old Rush Limbaugh and Ann Coulter gets through with it, they'll have half the Americans believing that it's a disgrace.
But among the list of people who voted to stop the occupation, Nick Joe Rahal. Congressman Rahal did the right thing, and I'm proud of him.
Yeah, what did Rockefeller do?
Well, it's not in the Senate yet. We got to get to Rockefeller, and here in West Virginia, everybody in the country got to get to their senators and wear them out. You know, I made a call to Rahal's office last week, and I said, listen. I expect Congressman Rahal to vote against this funding bill.
Mm-hmm.
And I get a feeling a lot of people did.
Well, I will.
So now I owe him a thank you.
Yeah. Well, If there had been somebody running against him this time, I'd have voted against him just because of just cramming that one thing down her throat ahead of time of endorsement. And I'm talking about whether they, when they come out and endorse any, either one of the candidates, any candidate, over and above and before the West Virginians vote to see which way they want it, then I don't have any use for them. And I didn't vote for Rockefeller, I'm going to tell you straight.
Neither did I.
Lady, I forgot her name. I didn't know either one of the other people, but I voted for the woman. And I don't like juniors, and I hope I'm not offending anybody, but juniors, somebody thought enough of him to call him, you know, name him after their dad, and usually them kind of people who've got plenty of money already, and him being on the ticket probably indicated that. But that's probably not a very good reason. But anyway, I never have liked the guy very much. The only thing I ever seen him do, two things really, is he does take up for the veterans when he's on the veterans committee, and he worked with Hillary on that national health deal. And other than that, for a man that's supposed to have the power and everything he's got, Bob, I ain't seen too much for him. And maybe you probably know a lot more about it than I do. But since I've been out of politics, pretty much, you know, I don't keep up with them as tight as you do.
No, that's
I don't have a
lot. Don't sandbag, Ed. I know you keep up with stuff.
But maybe a little bit.
Yeah, I see.
I don't particularly like him, and I don't understand Byrd not coming out with something, you know, and maybe he has, and it hadn't been covered, but he hasn't been for anybody yet. I guess he's waiting on the, like Biden said, he said he'd fight like the devil for the whoever the nominee was, but he wasn't endorsing nobody. He wasn't getting his superdelegate vote, and I guess that's probably the way Byrd feels too, you reckon?
You know what? At the end of the day, I'm guessing... I'm guessing Byrd's going to come down on Obama simply because back a couple of years ago when Barack Obama came and did the Jefferson Jackson Day dinner down in Charleston, it was expressly for the purpose of helping Robert Byrd raise money for his reelection bid. So I'm guessing that Robert Byrd will support Barack Obama.
Well...
but again, that's pure speculation on my part.
Yeah. Well, I look at another angle that worries me. Byrd belonged to the Klan, and I'm sure you knew that.
Sure.
And I'm not sure they ever get past that. They say they do, but he used the N-word, I despise using the letter.
No, he's used the word in the last 10 years on the public airwaves.
He's used the last 5 years.
Okay.
And not even that far back. But I question that part of him. Where is he really mentally when it comes to the black race?
I don't know. I don't know. Maybe at his age, he's working on his afterlife. But it is true. I mean, I'm basing it on this. Barack Obama came and addressed the Jefferson Jackson Day dinner as the keynote speaker, and the first 15 minutes of his remarks were all putting the shine on Robert Byrd. So I'm guessing that as far as superdelegates in West Virginia are concerned, that it's Robert Byrd, Nick Ray Hall, and Jay Rockefeller at the very least for Obama. And if I wouldn't be Joe Manchin. No, he got on TV and lectured Obama on election day. So I'm guessing he'll cast his superdelegate vote for Hillary. I have no doubt in my mind.
Yeah, well,
Shelley Moore, Shelley Moore is, of course, a Republican, so she's not a superdelegate. I wouldn't be surprised if Bob Wise is a superdelegate.
Ex-governor, yeah. Bush is what gets me, though, is, I listened to a little commentary-like thing talking about where we stood in comparison to the other countries and how much that we still got this attitude, this arrogance about us here at home, not West Virginia, but the nation, that we are superior, that we're it. And all these other countries in the meantime has been growing and acquiring power and prestige with each other, and here we are talking about barring China and Russia, and my gosh, you're talking about a terrible mistake. You're talking about both of them are as powerful as we are now, and Russia don't owe us now. They're out of debt to us, and they don't owe us a thing, and China has really got us over a barrel. And here we are talking about putting them in isolation. I don't know.
No, it gives you the creeps. But by the same token, you know, China's got us. So you know, we don't have China over a barrel. We're going to isolate them. They can isolate us.
That's what I'm talking about. You know, here we, you know, we're forgetting who is who. I think. And, you know, being a consuming nation now, I don't think they could do a whole lot to put us in a real bind. But anyway, I just thought I'd call in and give my 2 cents worth and be so glad when that idiot that, you know, and I know everybody uses that term, it's
yep.
Loose. But
January 20th cannot come fast enough for me. I just fall on my knees and pray that on January 20th I'm not saying President McCain.
But you won't be. It'd take a dramatic change because you mark her down, Bob. When this spitting and spatting that Hillary and Obama gets through, they may lose 10% of the voters and they may go to because they're bitter over their candidate not losing. But where does that still leave? That still leaves 70-75% of the people are going to be voting Democrat. And a lot of Republicans are going to be voting Democrat. And
That last part, Ed, I want to believe that. I want to believe that. But you know what? I've had too many years of hearing, and you know, you hear it, you tune in that right-wing show in Beckley. And you hear it, you know, Republican, it's them Democrats always voting a straight ticket, don't they? They're doing the blah, 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 blah. You know what? We're Democrats. We're all over the ticket.
Yeah.
But a Republican, they'll vote that, when it comes to the, you know, when it comes to the end of the day and they open their mouth and they kind of lick that fang with their tongue, they realize what they are and those are your straight ticket voters.
Yeah. And you're right, but several people called in, and Steve didn't like it too good, but several people called in and changed their, and one was Dirty Bob, the guy they called Dirty Bob. He called in and changed his, politics so he could vote for Mel Kastler. So you had about three that done that, and it's hard, I mean, that publicly done it, openly on radio, but, it's hard to tell how many of them because I still believe that the majority of the people, regardless of what party they belong to, want somebody that is straight and forward and open or transparent is the more modern word to use now, I think, with the public. That's what they want. Now, these people like Bush and his cronies, and some of the ones that call in on Steve, yeah, they're, one of them said that if Bush jumped over New River Gorge Bridge, he'd follow him. I say, hooray, hooray, go. But that be as it may, you're going to see, see if my prediction don't come true, and it's worth another Coke.
All right, sounds good to me, Ed.
See you later. Bye.
All right, I'll tell you what, I'll put you on hold, okay?
All right, thank you.
Uh-huh. Talk to you later. I appreciate Ed's optimism, I do. But as a pessimist, you see, and that's just how I am, as a pessimist, I am never disappointed and occasionally pleasantly surprised. See how it works? Yeah. So that's the first hour, and a darn fine one, I think it was. I hope you do, too. You can get in on the conversation, you know that, 304-658-3333. Or toll-free 877-443-2366. It's all about you. It's not about me. No, not here. Not on Conversation Radio. Not on America's Liberal Voice. Not on the Horn.
Remember the days of the old schoolyard? We used to laugh a lot. Oh, don't you remember the days of the old schoolyard? When we had imaginings and we had all kinds of things and we left and needed love, yes, I do. Oh, and I remember you. Remember the days of the old schoolyard? We used to cry a lot. Oh, don't you remember the days of the old schoolyard? When we had simplicity.
It's your second hour in the Liberal Sandbox, and you're head on with Bob Kincaid.
All right, coffee break's over. Back on your head. Hey, I heard it's not direct, but it's kind of cool. Ran across something earlier today. On his program earlier today, Tom Hartman said that he will no longer use the phrase mainstream media. Wow. Where have you heard that before? Tom is going to replace that goofy phrase, mainstream media. He's going to replace it with the phrase corporate media. Now, you know what we decided a week ago, that we would replace it with, we refer to them now as the for-profit media. Because that, sure, corporate media, whatever, but the purpose of a corporation is what? Yes, to make a profit. In fact, the sole fiduciary duty that a member of a corporate board of directors or a corporate officer owes to the corporation is to make a profit. There are no ethical duties. There are no philosophical duties. The only duty a board of director member or corporate officer holds is to make a profit. And that is why we skipped right past corporate media and went to for-profit media. The FPM, the for-profit media. That's what they are. But it was nice to hear Tom, whom I hold a great deal of respect for, walking away from the tired and bedraggled and entirely inaccurate moniker mainstream media. Of course, the syndicator is Air America, and Air America is a corporation, and that would mean that he, oh dear. But you get the idea. All right. I'm not going to get through. But how can you not? George Bush called us Nazis today. Or perhaps worse, he called us collaborators. Said that, and Ed alluded to it in his phone call. George Bush said that we want to sit down and, well, I'll play you the audio in a minute. You can make your own decision. I remember a time when right-wing blowhards, the Hannity jobs, that life support system for a hairdo, and O'Reilly and Flimball and Bortz and the Wiener and that whole filthy crowd would have absolute hissies on the air if some Democrat or someone that they had decided was a liberal so much as set foot across the Rio Grande or across across into Windsor, Ontario, or somewhere that wasn't the new United States, and so much as sneezed in a fashion that they declared wasn't sufficiently American or doing sufficient obeisance to the Bush administration. You remember those days? I remember those days. Hell, they did it. They did it to Natalie Maines, now, didn't they? Remember when Natalie Maines was in concert in London and she said she was personally ashamed as a Texan that George Bush was from Texas? They did everything but tar and feather that poor woman. Didn't they? Yeah, they did. And all the right-wing blowhards got on there and they used that tired old aphorism. Politics ends at the water's edge. We can have our disagreements at home, but I tell you what, when you get in a foreign country, you don't dare criticize Merca. Well, let's see. What's that string of letters? I-O-K-I-Y-A-R. Iakiar. It's okay if you're a Republican. Because by now you know that George W. Bush, that man, that thing, which will mercifully pray God, pray dog, pray flying spaghetti monster, Buddha, Allah, whoever's out there listening, E.T. for heaven's sakes, any of you, just pray that he leaves P. peacefully and quietly on January the 20th, 2009. Every day is a day closer to being a Bush-free America. We hope. But he took a little publicity trip on our dime. He was in Israel today, inconveniencing the people of Tel Aviv and Jerusalem. He went to Masada, a place that absorbed the blood of some genuine zealots and people who loved their land. Well, let's start with the funny side of the trip. What do you say? He really did. He went to Masada, and Masada overlooks the Dead Sea. And they were walking around. There was a tour guide. And at one point, Israeli Prime Minister Ehud Olmert took a sip of water from a silver cup and then handed it to George Bush. And George, in his chimpish way, looked down into the cup and then put it down like it had a snake in it, or a big old spider. And he looks up and says, "Where's the doctor?" And then turned around and gave Olmert a big old hug. See, that's the hypocrisy of it all. George Bush wasn't going to drink after Ehud Olmert. Because, you know, George is a Christian. Problem was, it wasn't drinking water. Ehud Olmert screwed up. It was for demonstration purposes. The guide at Masada explained to the chimperer that had he had the good common sense to pour the water on a model of Masada's humongous system of dams and channels and cisterns that could hold 40,000 cubic meters of water, that what they would see was how the water system at Masada was set up. No, really. The leader of the free world today, on a mountaintop nigh unto the Dead Sea, was baffled by a glass of water. Really. Not kidding. Wish I was. Jesus, his presidency's turning into, like, I don't know, 2001. The director's cut with outtakes, where the chimpanzee gets the bone and goes whack in his own head and knocks himself senseless. George Bush was defeated today by a glass of water. Of course, this is the same George Bush who, when he goes abroad, has to have his effluvium collected by the Secret Service. Again, not kidding, wish I was. Was it the trip to Austria where we first found out about this? That the Secret Service collects his urine and his... I don't even want to talk about it. Because they're afraid that some world sinister... Maybe Dr. Evil will get hold of it and determine how many weird, mood-altering, mind-enhancing drugs the little freak's on. And so today, he is, after almost 8 years, they got the message home to him. George, don't drink anything that anybody hands you that isn't from the Secret Service. Or maybe Laura. So Ehud Olmert takes a little itty-bitty sip of water out of a silver cup, hands it to George, and George stares at the glass of water like a cow staring at a new gate. Holy crap. You suppose there's another president out there who's ever been baffled by a glass of water? What is this water? God, even Helen Keller, you know, you took her, you know, Annie Sullivan takes her to the pump and cranks the water over her hand, and that poor child, deaf, mute, and blind, goes, water! George Bush stares at it, puts it down, what is it? And then he giggles and gives Olmert a hug. And of course, I'm an excellent president. Govern slow on the driveway in the White House. And the whole time, it's just a demonstration for showing how the brilliant, brilliant plumbing system at Masada on a mountaintop above the Dead Sea in a desert region worked. It was a demonstration for 2,100-year-old plumbing. Somebody give me a hug. But that wasn't the end of George's day. No, first he embarrasses us, and then he outright insults us. Dear God. Because George Bush, in violation of that ancient political maxim that politics ends at the water's edge, George Bush gave an address to the Israeli governing body in which he told that, well, screw it. Play the audio, Bob.
Some seem to believe that we should negotiate with the terrorists and radicals as if some ingenious argument will persuade them they have been wrong all along.
This is going to be difficult. As if some ingenious argument will persuade them that they've been wrong all along. On the other hand, not presenting them with any argument at all will, however, convince them that they've been, wait a minute, right all along.
We've heard this foolish delusion before.
Here it comes. Get your armbands out, America. Work on your goose-stepping. George Bush is about to call you a Nazi. Oh, you're just going to love it.
As Nazi tanks crossed into Poland in 1939, an American senator declared, "Lord, if I could only have talked to Hitler, all this might have been avoided."
Let's be fair. He's not calling us Nazis. He's saying that we're Nazi enablers in the Knesset, in Israel. Wow. That takes some chutzpah. And it wasn't just us, it was one person in particular. It was Barack Obama that he was aiming at. Because after all, remember, from the audio that we played last night of Bingo Billy Bennett and Joe Lieberman, well, nah, I'm not even going down that road.
We have an obligation to call this what it is, the false comfort of appeasement.
Yep, give him a bowler hat, an umbrella, and an overcoat. And Barack Obama is the spitting image of Neville Chamberlain. He did this in the Knesset in Israel. Now, bear in mind that Dana Perineal, the White House spokes jerk, came out and said, well, he wasn't really talking about Obama. Now, I realize that when you're running for president, you think you're the center of the universe, but there's lots of people in the country who want to appease the terrorists. Horse feathers. He aimed it straight at Obama. Because Obama has said in the past that it might be a good idea to talk to these people before we decide to nuke them. But I want to back up to something. Hold on just a minute.
We've heard this foolish delusion before. As Nazi tanks crossed into Poland in 1939, an American senator declared, Lord, if I could only have talked to Hitler, all this might have been avoided.
You know what? That's true. That's true. But, as is often the case with these repig-licking bastards, it's only partially true. Because the person in question, he didn't quite give all the skinny on. It was a United States senator. It was indeed. It was. It was a senator from Idaho. Nope, it was not Senator Prescott Bush. It was Senator David Bora. I believe that's the man's name. I got to tell you the truth. I had an Internet Explorer crash. I had the page up. I don't have the page up anymore, so I'm trying to find him now on Wikipedia. David Bora, a Republican from Idaho, who said, when he heard that the tanks had rolled across Poland, Lord, if only I could have talked to Hitler, this could have been avoided. I've got the guy. William E. Bora. William E. Bora, B-O-R-A-H. Took me a minute. Sorry for the delay there. No. There's just layers upon layers of irony here. I'm reminded by our buddy Mark Levine about Prescott Bush, who not only appeased the Nazis, but did business with them and got busted for it. Under the Trading with the Enemies Act. Yeah. And it's still in the National Archives. But you can't get anybody in the for-profit media to mention it. Oh, joy. But William E. Bora did say that. Lord, if only I could have talked to him, all this could have been avoided. The early 20th century's answer to Larry Craig, because he was a Republican senator from Idaho. Do they not... there's that question I'm asking all the time. How stupid do they think we are? Did they not think that we would look up the quote? Did they not think that we would actually... Do they not know about the series of tubes? I mean, George Bush can't email anymore for national security reasons, like we talked about. But the rest of us can. We can look for all kinds of stuff on the internet, and we can find out that George is quoting an appeasement Republican. He just is. I'm a Neville Chamberlain. You're a Neville Chamberlain. We're all Neville Chamberlains because we don't want to shoot first and ask questions later. Because we learned that by shooting first and asking questions later, sometimes you get yourself into wars that you had no business being in the first place. And generally speaking, as a matter of public policy, shooting first and asking questions later is not the American way. Because if you shoot first, that means, by definition, that you've started the war. And we did, after all, have this little meeting at Nuremberg where we declared to the Nazis that they were not being punished for losing the war, but in fact they were being punished for starting the war. You gotta wonder if anybody in the Knesset knew that he was referring to a member of his own party. Does anybody in the Knesset, I mean, honest to God, would they have let him into the Knesset if they'd known that his granddaddy was a Nazi collaborator? Last I heard, they take a dim view of Nazis over there, pretty much like I do. I don't want them anywhere near me. I don't like Nazis. Do you suppose they know? Has anybody pulled Ehud Olmert aside and said, Ehud, his granddaddy helped get your granddaddy baked. Do you suppose? I don't know. Let's go to the phones. Welcome to the program.
Hi, this is Juanita.
Hey, Juanita.
I'd like to say a couple of things about, comes to my mind about Bush.
Mm-hmm.
There's an old comic strip, used to be in the newspapers years ago, called Little Abner.
Oh, I remember Little Abner well.
And you know that, all kind of characters. And I can't help but visualize this very much so. Is the little guy that always had the black cloud over him.
Oh, yeah.
And that's the way I feel. I feel like there's a black cloud over this country and myself, too, you know. And the other thing is, let me see. Well, I forgot what I was going to say the other was.
Well, you know, we collaborators, we tend to forget things, and we appeasers.
And there was a... I think it was Quo Vadis, where, remember Peter Ustinov?
Oh, yes.
He played Nero in the movie.
Yes, he did. You're absolutely right.
And he reminds me of that portrayal of Nero, but I think he'd probably be more like Caligula, you know, because I think he has less...
Well, in both
in the case of both
Nero and Caligula, they were beloved by their people at first, and the people eventually turned on them. So, there is that comparison.
But those are two things that just come to my mind all the time, and it's just like, when will it end? When will it end?
January 20th. Just to keep telling yourself, Juanita. January 20th. January 20th. January 20th. Yeah, hope.
What was the bad news you said happened, Dave? My computer's been down and...
No, that was the nasty stuff.
Oh, okay, so I had the same problem.
You know, George Bush calling his fellow Americans, you know, Nazi appeasers. Nazi appeasers.
Oh, I know they're really impressed over there with that. But I know it's so embarrassing to have somebody like that. When you know what a Democrat would do, it'd be different. Those people in Iraq would already have electricity. I believe that, don't you?
Sure. They had electricity before we started bombing them.
Yeah, but I mean, you know, taken care of and not be treated like, I mean... Please, it's really bad. But anybody that prays, I pray, if they would agree with me, to pray that this war would come to a sudden end, because it can.
Well, the Democrats in the House went in the right direction today. But there's
hallelujah.
More.
Hallelujah.
You know, they killed the Iraq funding bill. There were plans to just roll over and play dead.
He was going to say no questions asked.
Yeah.
And they didn't.
No, they killed it. They voted it down.
What was Nancy's idea? Was she for it or against it?
That's an open question. She was kind of.
Yeah. Well, she lost. That's good. One for us.
Well, she had tied in a bunch of domestic spending to it as well.
Yeah.
And George didn't like that. And the Republicans didn't like it either. So a whole bunch of Democrats and two Republicans killed that thing. Now it goes over to the Senate anyway,
mm-hmm.
where we need the Senate Democrats to filibuster the thing and just end it.
Yeah.
But on the other hand, if they pass a bill and send it back to the House, we've still got to starch up and make sure that the House guts up and continues to oppose it.
Yeah. Well, I'm hoping something's going to happen, break loose, and soon.
Yeah.
My hope. Well, I'll let you go, Bobby.
All right.
Take care.
All right. You take care, Juanita. We'll talk soon. Bye now. And let's see if we've still got anybody here. Yeah. Hi, welcome to the program.
Bob, hey, it's Sandra.
Sandra, how are you, dear?
I can think of some other sort of Roman activities that could happen, but, a Senate activity, but I won't go there because I'll probably get in trouble for saying it.
Yeah, let's don't. They can't get us for thinking.
But listen, is it Turn the Monkey Loose week? Left George Bush. What's up? Why, you know what I mean? It's just like, this fool, as soon as I heard him talking about tanks rolling in, and you beat me to the punch, I was thinking, yeah, while tanks were rolling in to Czechoslovakia, your grandfather and family was getting everything nice and cozy for them to roast up some Jews. It was just a joke. I mean, the man is so dumb, he don't even know how I
Well, did you notice he...
I mean, it was just, I was like...
Yeah, but this is one of
your own family history.
This was one of these. They know it. They just don't talk about it.
Well, no. What I'm saying though is that do they actually think we're that? Not everyone is hella dumb. I was sitting there thinking, you must be out of your mind, even bringing the connection up. You know, them people in the Knesset, they don't know.
But the for-profit media won't mention it. Like I said, this is all verifiable stuff. Even the stuff's in the archives, for God's sakes.
Well, no, but it's just, and you know, I'm so of George W. Bush. I mean, this man is so disgusting. I was rolling with Keith Olbermann. I'm thinking, dude, you're going to blow your head, going to explode up in here.
Yeah, they're going to come get Keith.
They're going to get him. I said, no, fool, you better try to back off. Next thing you know, you and your young girlfriend is going to be disappeared.
I mean, when he got to shut the hell up, when Keith Olbermann got to shut the hell up, Sandra, I was honestly wondering if it was going to be hell.
Oh, no, I didn't. Yeah, I thought he was going to drop the F-bomb up in here. I'm thinking, oh, this boy is on his way out. Something's up. But then he didn't say that because I thought he was going out in a blaze of glory. Because I'm like, are we going to see Keith tomorrow? Because he didn't look right. And that little speech he gave was, wow, I guess he was feeling a little bit upset. He must be bringing in hella ratings for them to let, for MB military to let him off like that. What do you think? I don't understand, because I'm like, how is this fool getting away with these kind of comments on that network?
You know why? Because, again... And this is not me gooning on Keith Olbermann. He works. See, I'm in love with this little new phrase we've got here, Sandra. He works for the for-profit media. And right now, General Electric is making a profit off of Keith Olbermann.
Well, that's what I'm saying. They must be making a whole bunch, because the only thing that subsumes their propaganda is money. You see what I mean? And even that is dubious when they're trying to get the war effort going. You know what I mean? They got rid of Phil Donahue when he was having big ratings, but I guess President Monkey's ratings are so low, they feel it's okay. I mean, I'm not too sure I'm understanding why Keith is on TV.
You know, I also think there's a certain, there's something involved. They know that he's making Chris Matthews' head explode, too.
Oh, please. Yeah, well, Keith is obviously hella much brighter than, come on now. I mean, Chris Matthews is, I understand he's a columnist and a, you know, journalist and all that, but he's an idiot because he can't alter his behavior and he's a jerk. It's like, you're an idiot. I don't know why people don't put these people in check because he comes across as a complete nincompoop.
Yeah, well, he, Sandra, I heard this at the beginning of the day, and I just about came out. I about came out of my clothes, came out of my skin, about pulled my hair out. I've come to expect anything from George Bush, but somehow getting equated with the with a Nazi appeaser in front of the Knesset. I wasn't ready for that.
Well, no, but it's just, I mean, he is, I don't know if he's counting on that people are so scattered with their history or what, but why in the world would he even make these sort of, that kind of comment? I just was like, yeah, it really, you know, it was one of them ones where I was definitely sort of speechless and thinking, damn, this fool needs to be yanked. They need to, you know what I'm saying? He needs to go. I don't care if the election is close. They really need to prosecute and get rid of him. He seems to be getting worse. Am I missing something?
No, you're not missing anything at all. Had you seen or heard the story about him with the him getting foiled by the glass of water though?
Huh? What?
That was before the Knesset speech. They took him up to Masada. I mean, this is right up here, right up there with him being stumped by the doors in China.
Oh, there, no, what, you know, that's, yeah, classic, that. What happened with this one?
Ehud Olmert took a little sip of water out of a silver glass and handed it over to George, and George put it down like it had shocked him and said, "Where's the doctor?"
What?
Yeah, oh yeah, and it turns out he was just supposed to pour it on this model of Masada so that they could see how the waterworks work, Sandra. But instead, he was afraid to drink it because he thought that Ehud Olmert might be trying to poison him.
No, you know what? You are making this up.
No, ma'am.
No.
No. No. No, I'm not.
I mean,
really, really not.
Do I need to bring out the Reagan Trust but Verify? Come on now. Where can I find
all the way down to a glass of water? Trust but Verify. You know, I mean, we like you, and we give, you know, we give your government a lot of money, but, you know, I ain't drinking after you, Ehud Olmert. I might get something.
Well, you don't even know how to say the man's name. Remember that at the Annapolis when he was got stumped trying to say his name? And
well, he blew his big line during the speech in front of the Knesset. He said, "When the taunts rolled into Poland."
Oh, I mean, he didn't even get the tanks right?
No, he blew it. Wait a minute. I got it right here. I got that. You tell me. He has to go back and correct himself because he says when the taunts rolled into Poland.
Okay.
Oh, sorry.
We have an obligation.
Here we go.
As Nazi tanks crossed into Poland in 19...
Do I lie?
Listen, you know what? The thing is that I feel like I'm living in some sort of parallel universe because it's like a running comedy hour with this freak. But there's so much destruction and death associated with him. See what I mean?
Well, yeah, and of course, he's got his forces back here on the ground, too, Sandra, because no sooner had he come out and said that Barack Obama was a dirty little appeaser than Joe Lieberman piped up and said, "He's got it right. He's got it 100% right."
Oh, yeah, well, you know what? I am like, you know, the Democrats need to handle their business. They ain't handling it. Get rid of this fool. Take his chairmanship. Tell him to sit the hell down. I'm about as sick of Joe Lieberman with his disgusting, whiny, Elma Fudd-like voice. I can't stand that guy. And why? You know what? He's horrible. He's, you know, it's like worse than Zell Miller. Far worse, okay?
Yeah, because Zell Miller just looked crazy.
Well, yeah, but this guy is disgusting, and the slavish attachment that Obama's already doing to Israel. He had already turned himself inside out. What else he need to do? You know, with the, I'm so sick of all that anyway. God, I'm sick of it.
Lieberman, here's the exact quote. Let's see if I can make it go here.
Senator McCain's supporter, Democratic Senator Joe Lieberman, who endorsed him back in December, also chimed in saying, quote, President Bush got it exactly right today when he warned about the threat of Iran and its terrorist proxies like Hamas and Hezbollah. It is imperative that we reject the flawed and naive thinking that denies or dismisses the words of extremists and terrorists when they shout death to America and death to Israel. And that holds that if only we were to sit down and negotiate with these killers, they would cease to threaten us.
Those are Lieberman's words.
No, you know, it's just so, you know, nasty. And, you know, then you have these Democrats who are all whining about, oh, the primary season. No, what you're talking about right now, that's some vicious stuff. That's vicious. And that's what we are trying to fight against. You know what I mean? I'm just sort of like, I don't give a F about this primary. That stuff right there, though, wow, that's some scary stuff.
Yeah, this is not, I mean, it's got an election year element to it because Barack Obama is the presumptive nominee of the Democratic Party. But it's not, the White House came out because they had to haul out poor little Dana Perineal. And she said that it, you know, that the president's comments weren't aimed at Obama, but they do include him.
Well, no. I am like, yeah, it is so disgusting, but I look at that election that just happened in, of all places, Mississippi. I don't think people hearing it. I think they are sick to death of the Republicans, their minions, their foreign policy, and everything else with them. I really do think that even the for-profit media is going to have a hard time trying to sweeten this pot for people. I think people are fed up. I don't know. I'm starting to think that McCain, once we get our nominee, he is buried. I don't see it. I don't see him coming up. You saw him coming out. Oh, they'll be out on the 2013, because I think they feel in it. How many elections can they lose in a row?
If the past is any indication, Sandra, they can lose a bunch.
Well, no.
I don't know if we're at that place where what happened to the Republican Party under Herbert Hoover happens to the Republican Party under George Bush. I can pray like crazy that it is.
Well, I mean, I just am sort of, I think that, you know, people get all worked up about the presidential election, you know, because it's the top of the ticket. But what affects people at home is closer to home, you know what I mean? And if some of these Congress people are going to be pulled off, that's a much better prospect for me. I mean, I want us to get the White House, but I think a sea change in the Congress would be so good at this point.
It might actually embolden people like Nancy Pelosi to take real steps. I mean, this business with this vote in the House today was at least symbolically huge, Sandra.
Well, they rejected the request and asked for another pullout and turned it over to the Senate. Is that what it was?
Yeah.
Yeah. No, it's a little bit different than their usual just bending over, I guess. But I get upset because I know the Congress could end it now if they wanted to, and I'm sick of the prevaricating. You know what I mean?
But the one thing about it, yeah, I do understand that. But the one thing is, by not the biggest thing they can do, the easiest way to end it is by not acting.
Yeah, no.
It doesn't take a bill. It doesn't take a law. It takes them sitting on their hands.
Yeah, they can sit on their hands and hold it up until. I understand. I just think that, you know, they always get my hope up, and then they do some maneuver where, oh, and they cave, you know. Because how much money is he asking for this time?
Well, this thing was $163 billion.
And they are, it's going to the Senate to do what?
To be reconsidered anew.
Okay, so, and they could, well, are they going to try to slow it up? I mean,
now, the Senate can cave, which the Senate, you know, Harry Reid, I mean, they're very good at it. They can cave and pass a bill, and then it'll bounce back to the House.
Oh, and so they can play a ping pong game for a bit?
Yeah.
Shut up. Well, I didn't realize it was that kind of party, because I thought that, you know, Pelosi didn't have to be bringing out these bills, see? She has control over what she's putting on the floor, don't she?
Yeah, she does, and she had loaded this bill up with a modest little bit of domestic spending, which just had the Republicans all tied up in knots. But eventually, they decided to vote for it because, and for once, they got procedurally run around. It was pleasant.
Huh. Well, maybe the Democrats. You know, it takes a while. They've been out of power for a while. But the thing is that this is such a time sensitive issue, like people dying. You know what I'm saying?
It's yeah.
A learning curve. I'm done with it. They need to know what they're doing by now, you know?
Yeah, it's like starting the lawnmower up for the first time in the spring, Sandra.
Mm.
You know, the first time you pull the cord, it kind of goes, and then it gets going. Well, I'm tired of listening to the engine hesitate. I want to see the blade start spinning.
Yeah, and I'm sick of the 60-volt thing too, because I know how our government works, and that's such a load that they've sold people. It's just unbelievable. It is such a load.
It is indeed, Sandra.
Really
good to hear from you, dear.
Huh?
Good to hear from you. I don't want to take up too much of your time because I know. Usually I hear somebody hollering in the background or your niece or nephew
care. Oh no, I'm actually okay today. The only other thing I wanted to ask you about, if you still want to chat.
Oh, go ahead. Yeah.
Because I was just I'm just mortified by that. You know that tape that guy played with them. With Rumsfeld and that dinner.
Yeah.
Have you touched on that yet?
I haven't touched on it yet. And
listen, you know what? I think that just scared me. I was like, oh my God. You know, it was just so, it was creepy and weird. And to hear them actually making these sort of decisions, and it was horrible. That was
to hear Donald Rumsfeld actually say that George Bush is a victim of his own success, and then say, "But the American people will come back to us after the next attack." If anybody else did that, we'd be convening a jury, if not a lynch mob.
No, but it's just, I mean, that's the sort of stuff that gives. You know, all sorts of material to anybody who wants to question, you know, 9/11.
But Rumsfeld sitting there, that's not a conspiracy theory. That's real.
That's what I'm saying.
I mean, that's not a conspiracy theory. That's a conspiracy.
No, but that, to me, I'm like, you know, if he's being so cavalier about pending attacks or the next, you know, it's just sort of like, well, you know what? What are you people doing? You know, what have you been doing? And do I really need to keep revisiting, you know, 9/11 truth.
I want to know how the tape came out. Did you hear how many times they said this is off the record?
Yeah, no, that's no. What was the deal with that tape? And
I don't know. I'm thinking somebody dropped the dime on Rummy.
You know what I'm saying? I'm like somebody who just was hedging their bets during it, right? And just thought, let me just tape this. Is that what an M job is?
I don't know because, you know, the one thing that was in the foreground of the audio was whoever it was that was having lunch was just beating the hell out of his fine bone china plate with that silverware.
Right.
Did you hear how loud silverware on the plate was?
Yeah, I was like, oh, I just thought, wow, gluttonous, disgusting pig people who are like destroying this country.
But that tells you where the microphone was.
Right. So somebody must have had some maybe right under their plate, you know what I mean?
Yeah, or in their shirt pocket or, you know, one of those little tiny digital recorders.
Yeah, because there's so many. I mean, I even had the one. You know, they're really easy to come by, but I'm just thinking that who, you know, all these cowards who wait a half a decade before they expose stuff. You know, I'm about sick of that too.
Yeah. I want to hope that it was a sneaky recording. I want to think that they didn't think they were being recorded, and that, you know, this is all just going to bust them wide open. But how much of this is, I mean, you may watch more TV than I do, Sandra. How much of this has been all over the for-profit media?
No, you know what? Sometimes I watch little TV with my nieces to make sure they're not getting too indoctrinated, but that's it. I don't do TV no more. So I couldn't tell you.
Well, I don't either. I got 1 hour a week, and everybody knows what it is.
Okay. You have your own little stories.
Yeah, I do. I do 1 hour a week, Sandra. And so far, Tony Bourdain hasn't gotten run around to running the Rumsfeld tape. This ought to be played in front of a jury.
Mm.
With Donald Rumsfeld sitting over in the dock, because the important thing is who the other people were at the luncheon or whatever it was.
And who were they?
Those were all the so-called military experts, the retired military types that have been all over the television, pumping up the war, ginning up the, we're having great success in Afghanistan and Iraq, blah, 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 blah.
What year was that?
Let's see, Rumsfeld left in January of 2005, so it has to be between 2003 and the end of 2004.
Wait, Rumsfeld been gone for that long?
Mm-hmm.
Oh, right, it was right after the election. See, time is going too fast, and we're still here. You see what I'm saying? We're still in this sort of, Alice in Wonderland-type world. Rumsfeld, damn, is he still breathing?
Sadly, yes.
He must be old as dirt, though. Come on.
He was old as dirt when he came in. For God's sakes, he started out under Nixon.
Boy, that's saying evil lives a long time. That's true, man. These people don't ever go away.
he's probably got the whole Darth Vader rebreathing thing that he shares with Dick Cheney from time to time.
No, he lives over
on the Maryland shore and sits there, high and mighty, and
Know what mansion he lives in?
No,
he lives in the mansion of the slaveholder who broke Frederick Douglass. Let me just give you that little tidbit.
No.
I forget the name of the slaveholder, just some horrible person who Douglass spent a long time in his book talking about. This man was a notorious tormentor of black people. And this is a mansion that Rumsfeld bought.
Oh, my God.
So I just thought I'd share that.
Speaking of which, this is a little while back from before the primary, but it's something I never commented on, but I found it incredibly funny. Did you notice that back before the Indiana primary, when Hillary was challenging Barack Obama to a Lincoln-Douglas style debate, which I thought, it's a novel idea, but Fox News picked up on it and showed, and in describing a Lincoln-Douglas style debate, they showed a photograph of Abraham Lincoln and Frederick Douglass.
No, listen, I brought that in. I have a social history class. I brought my computer and showed the whole class. My class was rolling. The teacher almost fell over. He couldn't believe it. He could not believe it. I said, yes, yes. No one could believe it. They're like, oh, my God.
Yeah, not little bitty roly-poly, portly, pudgy Stephen Douglass.
No, not Stephen, the slave-holding Douglass. No.
No.
Frederick damn Douglass. And I was like, come on, man. This is not happening. I thought my head was going to explode. I was like, hello? You know, it was so wrong on so many levels.
But, that's what you get from Fox. Last night on Strictly Confidential, Peter Godbold played a clip from that show that runs overnight on Fox called Fox Red Eye.
Oh, uh-huh.
And I thought I was going to come unglued. John Fox and me and Peter joke and kid around and stuff during the horn section from 11 to midnight and everything, but mm-hmm. those people on Fox Red Eye, I don't think they've got a room temperature IQ between them.
Oh, yeah. Well, no, because that Frederick Douglass thing with them idiots making a big joke about, I told her to go find the tape, yuck, yuck, yuck. In the meanwhile, they got some black... I just thought, what is... were they trying just to keep a black face up there? Was it some sort of...
No, I think in this case, Sandra, there was nothing nefarious, just stupid.
Stupid, just real... Because that was... Listen, that was just... so dumb. I still can't get over that was real. I think I looked at it about 100 times because I was too disturbed by it,
Yeah, and you got O'Reilly. I love the video of O'Reilly coming unglued. That was a precious thing. Did you see the toupee on him? hadn't even moved on to the comb over yet. Still had the rug.
Happening? What was happening with the hair? That's what I was thinking, too. I'm like, you... Loofah molesting. Have you heard his audio book about the drug smoking? Have you heard that?
Oh yeah.
put my pipe up or some madness.
And these are the people who shape the opinions of the United States every day and every night.
Right. So it's just some sort of bad joke. I mean, it's no wonder that the ratings, I think, are dipping, aren't they?
Well, and look, I'm a West Virginian, Sandra. I'm a genuine, bona fide hillbilly. And even I sat there and watched what John Stewart did with the West Virginia election results, and I laughed until I thought I was just going to start bawling and heaving and rolling on the ground.
What did he do? See, I don't get a chance.
Everybody got to go to Comedy Central and see this, or maybe over at Crooks and Liars or something. He starts out calling it the long, flat, slow Bataan death march to the White House. And then he starts into why Hillary won West Virginia, with all the pundits describing, it was because of this, because of that, because of that. And then he cuts away to this one West Virginia voter who says, well, you know, I voted for her because he's of another race, and, you know, we've had a lot of problem with them over the years.
Oh, wait, he brought exit polling question?
Yeah, yeah. And then the next jump cut was to a woman outside the polling place who said, well, you know, he's a Muslim, and he wants to take the oath of office on the Koran. And at that point in time, he does this big old...
Wait, no. Back up. He wants to take the oath of office on a what?
Koran.
I thought you said a coat hanger.
No, on a Koran. That's how we say it around here, Sandra. On a Koran.
Listen... That's a shame. He didn't do that to West Virginia.
Yeah, he did. And, you know, I laughed my butt off.
Well, listen, 20% of your folks said, oh, no, we can't. He's black, you know, so they couldn't vote for him. And I'm like,
and look,
20%?
Sandra, you know, this is the question I've asked a couple of times, and I don't mean it the wrong way. What happened to what happened to the half of Obama that's white?
No. I've had a long discussion with, you know, some of my... melanin challenge friends. They don't seem to understand the one black rule. And, you know, they seem to think that, well, isn't his mama white? And I'm like, yeah. I said, how long have you lived in America? You see what I'm saying?
Oh, yeah.
And it's like Tiger Woods trying to came out with that, I'm a Cabalade, whatever the hell he thought.
Yeah, Cablin Asian. I remember
I'm
that.
I'm like, no, fool, you are a Negro. I don't care how much you swing a golf club, whatever the hell you're doing, what you marry, you're still a Negro. This is America. And it's unfortunate because that's what I think, too. I'm like, Obama, come out white. Do that. But they don't.
Mama was from Kansas.
I don't know why.
You know, home of Dorothy and all of that stuff.
I don't know why he need to, you know, he need to run that one, run that game, you know. But they don't seem to want to hold on to it.
But this is a country that is so sick and racially twisted, Sandra, that we had an entire lexicon for how black somebody was.
Not only that, but
you remember, I mean, octoroons and quatroons and
listen, and black people were totally mulled over by that because in Louisiana, where my folks are from, they had the paper bag test. If you're darker than a paper bag, you don't get to go. You understand what I'm saying? A paper bag.
That's a new one. Sorry.
You know I'm going to kill you, Bob.
Oh.
You know I'm always going to come up with.
No, I thought I'd heard everything. I've heard about the handwriting tests at the voting at the polls, where a black person would be asked to write their name with a ballpoint pen on a piece of wax paper. I've heard of the literacy tests at the polls where a black person would be asked to read a Chinese restaurant menu.
Yeah.
I have never heard the paper bag test.
No, this is black, you know, intra-black stuff in, you know, my generation and back where, you know, black people, how they were gauging folks. So they color struck down there to the point where, good Lord, you know, if you're too black, it's just teeth sucking and oh my god, this person can't be seen with me. It's really bad.
Oh Lord.
I don't mean to laugh. It's horrible because it's some internalizing crap. But yeah, the paper bag test, you know, I fell over. I think I must have laughed for a half a day on that one.
Jesus, that's too much. That's just way too much.
You know, of course I kept pulling out my paper bag on people. See if they could go.
You just carry a swatch with you?
You know what I'm saying? No,
not you.
We ran that one for a while because it is unbelievable. But that's Louisiana. Them people down there, you know, no. the light bright and damn near white, you know, Red Fox.
Yeah, oh yeah, oh yeah, 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 yeah.
Yeah,
we had the 8-track tapes and the vinyl recordings back in the day.
Yeah, well, he does the whole thing about people being light, bright, and damn near white, and that's the whole color struck thing. But yeah, you know, I'd like to think that, you know, by the time you and I are taking a dirt nap, all that'll be just sort of something for the history books because it's so ugly.
I hope you're right. I don't think you are though, because I think this is our curse. To a certain extent, you know, it goes down. It's like dividing fractions, Sandra. If you divide a 32nd, you get a 64th, and if you divide a 64th, you get 128th. But the thing is, you keep dividing, but you still get another number. You never get zero.
Yeah, it's just nobody. You're probably right, because I was just thinking about a conversation I had, because my nieces are like, the father is black and then Mexican and black, and somebody was just saying, oh, they almost got the black out. There's only a quarter left. I was like, are you kidding me with that?
Somebody out there is willing to remember that or take note of it, Sandra, because in all seriousness, the origin of this is not
Rumsfeld left office in December 2006. My bad.
Oh, okay. Whatever. It's,
but anyway, no, the origin of all this is not in poor whites and poor blacks. And I've beat on this a little bit lately. The origin of racism in America is something that was ginned up, dummied up, faked up, frauded up, rubed up, and cooked up by the money class.
Well, yeah, because...
To turn poor whites on poor blacks. And that is where it's stuck.
Oh yeah, and then they started, you know, altering the legal system to solidify it, because you had poor whites and Negroes running off together there for a minute. They're like, oh no, enough.
And that's the thing that is forgotten, is that the earliest days of the settlement of this continent involved slavery of virtually every color.
Well, and the whites and the blacks saw themselves. Yeah, it was a much more similar, more of a just a class separation, you know.
The difference was white slavery was for a set duration of time.
Right, and then they made and the black slavery. Well, the black indentured too was for a set time too, and then they changed the law where whites had a way out and the blacks were slaves for life.
But all along, you know, I go back to that Abraham Lincoln quote that I found last week, where he said it was immediately after the Civil War, you know, the Civil War just ended and he had not been assassinated yet, and he said, if we allow the Negroes to have arms, we will have a race war on our hands in the South. And that's when people came to him and said, Mr. Lincoln, I need, you know what we could do? We could ship them all to Panama to dig the canal. Because they were already talking about a Panama Canal back then.
Mm.
And he thought that was the neatest idea he had heard in a long, long time. And then his wife looked at him and said, you know, you never take me out. I want to go to the theater. And, you know, that was the end of that.
That's crazy. Wife of you?
Yeah.
Oh, God. Listen, no, but can you, I mean, I can't even wrap my head on how weird it must have been, you know, straight after the Civil War when they were trying to deal with, you know, yet another Negro situation.
But it's all predatory. You know, the hated carpetbagger that came south didn't come south to bring freedom to anybody. They came south to make a buck.
Mm.
And they came south to prey upon what they knew that Reconstruction would do to the South. And that's how families that had, you know, 40 acres of land or whatever for 200 years wound up having no acres of land after they got done out of it by the carpetbaggers and yada yada yada. You know, white folks that again, you know, saw an opportunity an opportunity to prey on people even after the elimination of slavery.
Right.
And that's where you wind up with stuff like sharecropping. You know, which Condoleezza Rice's grandparents were, but we won't go into that.
Oh, did she drag that story out?
Well, yeah, I mean...
Is that part of her, her folklore?
Yeah, her heritage, yeah. Yeah, I mean, that's the... Well, you're the one that said, you know, she forgot everything, but...
Well, yeah, okay, so you know how I feel about her. I just think she's a some sort of nightmare, really.
Well, I have to, I always have to, I have an obligation to bring up Condoleezza Rice whenever you and I talk.
Well, she hasn't been in the news, man. I thought she's, I don't, is she with her boyfriend over in Israel?
I don't know. That, you know, there was that story. Well, we won't go into that because that's,
you know,
just tacky.
When she made a mistake and called him her husband?
Yeah, yeah, my husband. I mean, the president. I think that's long about the same time that Pickles moved into the Mayflower Hotel.
Listen, I know I keep shifting up, but see, you reminded me with Pickles about that McCain lady. Is she high?
Oh, she is hateful.
Is she high? Oh, I know. She's horrible with her Sudan thing she's selling. No wonder she don't want to release her. I mean, she, I don't, I just, I look at her, I just think, ooh, that's not right. That's,
yeah, she,
right,
well, she's
her.
Probably got, she's probably heavily invested in the oppression mutual funds. You know, she's probably got stock in some slave labor knitting factory in Myanmar or something.
Well, no, but you heard her quote, no, are you going to release your tax forms? No, I'm like, damn, is she high?
Well, and but the thing is, the for-profit media said, well, okay.
And it's just why.
Meanwhile, they just about rode poor Teresa Hines Carey like a barred mule.
Well, they didn't like that B anyway. She was too vocal and emasculating for them. They didn't like her, but they like this sort of 60-year-old with some tits that point upward. It ain't right. You know,
oh, you're hurting
sag.
Me.
Oh, man, I couldn't believe when I looked at her. I thought, is she for real with those boobs?
Well, what's the phrase they use out on the left coast? She's had some work.
But she's had a lot of work. Jesus. No one 60 should have boobs going that direction. No.
I'm not going there.
No,
you can't make me go there.
No, but
I'll be reading hate mail all weekend long, Sandra.
They can just address it to me anyway. But no, I don't. I'm scared of her, and I don't want her in the White House. They all scared of Michelle. Damn, I think Cindy.
Oh, they're so scared. They're so scared of Michelle. They got downright nasty with her in Tennessee.
Well, not only that, but I like the whole idea. The story that I heard was like they were talking about Hillary on a ticket. No, apparently Michelle said, "Oh no, that B ain't gonna be nowhere near the vice presidency." So the story goes. Michelle ain't very fond of Hillary.
I don't think anybody's very fond of anybody in that whole little sewing circle right now.
I know, but
she would the Michelle was going to go down to Nashville, and the Tennessee Republican Party issued a welcoming memorandum to her, Sandra.
What?
And called for all the radio stations in Nashville to play patriotic music because it'll be the first time she ever heard any.
Well, no, what was her thesis at Princeton or wherever she went? What's the big controversy about that?
Oh,
what did she write about, reparations or something?
Oh, come on, uppity. I mean, you know. She was... It was 1985, and she wrote on... Oh, I don't know. What would I call it? Black empowerment issues?
Okay, so she was writing about black nationalism.
I think that's the way it's been casted. But bear in mind, all I've seen have been mainstream reports about it and right-wing comments. And for all I know, she wrote it in limerick verse because they're not going to tell you what it was.
Not only that, can we get back to the fact that she was at Yale? How more establishment can you get?
Well, no, it was Princeton and then Harvard.
Okay, well, whatever.
Yeah.
It wasn't like she was at Evergreen or Hampshire College, right?
No. She wasn't at Howard or anything.
Or Howard or one of the other, you know, black colleges. She was at, the Ivy League, like her hubby.
Yeah,
right?
Yeah. Well, you know, where everybody isn't black or white or red or yellow, everybody's green.
Right, you know, and so it's just sort of like if she was writing about Stokely Carmichael, well, so what, man?
You know,
I don't know.
Write about Eldridge Cleaver. You know, what the hell's happened to this country where you can't write about somebody?
David Horowitz.
Yeah, exactly. I mean, This is why I can't ever run for political office, because I had a class in college once, Sandra, where I read Soul on Ice, and I thought it was a pretty damn cool book and said so.
Well, I can't run for office because I was high on acid for 24 hours at Reed College in physics.
Well, we haven't gotten to that part of my resume yet, so.
You know, I'm not, no. I have, like, the biggest pass that wouldn't go. It would just be, I'd be destroyed in a day, basically.
Well,
but
that's America. Depending on who you are, you're not even safe going to church.
Oh, aren't they attacking the new minister of that church?
Yes, they are.
Is he black?
Yes, he is.
Okay, I mean, he's a black church.
I mean, you asked the first question, and I said yes. Did you need to ask the second question?
I don't know. I thought maybe.
What, you think that? They didn't bring Robert Schuller Jr. into Trinity Church of Christ.
Yeah, I just thought maybe they might have tried something different, like.
No, I watched his sermons on YouTube, and I tell you what, he's happening.
Oh, okay. Well, that sounds good.
He's got a degree from Yale Divinity School, but the right wing is doing everything in their power, Sandra. Everything in their power, kid you not, to demonize this guy too. I think he's like 32, 33 years old. He was associate pastor under Reverend Wright, and he did that thing that preachers do really, really well. And that is to take really moldy, tired, old Testament people and make them relevant to the congregation. So he said that Abraham was a pimp.
Well, you know what?
And poor old pale, pasty-faced right-wing America turned purple.
Well, no, the thing is that what I'm interested in is white people just now discovering black prophetic preachers? I'm so confused.
I don't know, because, I mean, in the course of my existence, you know, I was raised in a Southern Baptist church, and I tell you what, it is the best place. If you've got the insomnia, the back row of a Southern Baptist church is the place to get cured. That's the only healing goes on in the Southern Baptist church. They will heal your insomnia. And so as a result, growing up in Alabama, I went to a few AMEs and so forth, and you know what? I enjoyed it a heck of a lot more.
Well, no, I mean, I'm like, you know.
So I'm not, I don't understand. But, yeah, this white bread America, is that what they do in there?
Yeah, I mean, it's just so bizarre. I realize that the church is, you know, as they say, the most segregated hour in America. But I didn't realize it was that true. I mean, because I've been to, you know, churches that were mixed, and maybe because I live in California. But I haven't been to these churches where there is never any mixing.
I grew up in that church.
Well, I mean...
And you know what? I was back in Alabama a couple of years ago, and I talked to some people who go there now, and they said, do you know that we have some colored families now in the church? We do.
Oh, what year? What, recently?
Yeah, this was told to me within the last 2 years.
And
they got that sort of on the down low kind of thing going in the voice. We have some colored families in our church now.
Oh my God! I mean, okay.
They were so proud, Sandra. They were so proud.
Well, that's good. Well, no, listen. I'm not going to go negative because at least
no. I get it.
Step up.
But it drove these pasty faced doughy pink people on the right wing absolutely crazy, because this young minister said that I believe he said Jacob was a thug and Samson was a thug who went to the wrong hairdresser.
But you know,
and they just lost it.
No, but if these white people, do they actually think, where else will black people will talk about white folks? I'm sorry, and in the church. And maybe in a barbershop, but what do they think? I don't know. I just appalled at how naive and stupid some of these, you know, white people can be. I don't mean to be insulting. I'm just sort of like,
No. You're not insulting me. I'm with you.
I just don't get it. I can't believe that they're that shocked and horrified.
They're not shocked. They're not horrified, Sandra. They're terrified. They are that brand of conservative, racist, bigoted white woman is terrified, and that brand of bigoted, racist white man is utterly mystified, and because of all the ancient bigotries, he's also sexually intimidated.
I mean, this is like some sort of throwback. This stuff still goes on?
Sure does.
Well, you know what? It just popped in my mind.
I mean, my God, come on, Sandra, the Harold Ford ad.
Oh, that's right, because...
Harold, call me.
No, that's another thing that I'm always doing lately. Hey, Harold, call me. You know, because a lot of my friends are fairly politically astute. You know, it's a running joke. It's a running joke. Harold, call me. You know what I'm saying?
Yeah. I mean, and what's that trading on? That's trading on Mandingo, for God's sakes.
No, but we were sitting there thinking, damn, that's a ugly... That's all we were saying. We were like, could they find a better-looking one?
Well, I mean, she'd been a bunny or something. I mean, what do you want? Or a stripper? Because, you know... Are you a stripper? No, I'm an actress. Yeah, okay. Sure you are, with your clothes off. Yeah.
But, oh, God. Well, yeah, you're right. I guess that was recent, and it did sort of work, didn't it?
It only worked as much as it had to. If you're in a race where where you anticipate that the difference will be 2 or 3 percentage points on a fairly broad spectrum vote, that's all you need. And the Harold Call Me ad was plenty sufficient to bring out 2 or 3% unrepentant Klansmen and turn the tide.
Well, what was that? What about Hillary and her ad where she darkened him up like OJ? Did you see that?
Oh, I saw that.
He got a few shades darker?
Photoshop is an amazing thing.
But it was, you know, because it's just one of those things where, you know, I really do just sit back and I just have to suck the teeth and go, oh, my God, these white people are so out of their mind.
But see, Obama's in kind of a between a rock and a hard place, because on the one hand, if he says, here, let me show you a picture of my mama, and he shows her this pretty white woman, which she was, they'll go, oh, my God. And on the other hand, but do you see what I'm saying? Well, look, what was the Washington Post article from 2 or 3 days ago about that quoted the woman working for Obama in Lackawanna County, Pennsylvania, who had a Clinton supporter come up to her and point at Obama's picture on her T-shirt and say, he's a Muslim and a half-breed. How can you trust that?
Well, what about the monkey and the banana?
Oh, Jesus, in Marietta, Georgia, you know. What do you want out of Marietta, Georgia?
And to top it off, and I suppose I should let you go. But.
Although I do, I got to tell you, I think it's Random House that owns the rights to Curious George.
Oh.
And they're giving serious consideration to suing that SOB in Marietta.
Well, that's one way of doing it, is suing. Yeah, I mean, because that one is just over the top, and.
But you know how they explained why they might sue?
Why?
They said, clearly, this T-shirt does not represent the values that Curious George holds.
Well, listen, that's a whole nother funny. Are you kidding me?
No, ma'am.
Well, listen, the only other thing I'll say, and I'll leave you, is that, remember, John Stewart, you know, he'd be pushing it. Did you see an interview where he said, okay, Obama, are you going to enslave white people when you get into power?
Yeah.
I couldn't believe he asked him that.
Oh, you gotta go watch this West Virginia episode and see him do the spit take and then break for the Jack Daniels bottle on the next video clip. It's a precious thing.
Okay, listen, have a nice evening.
All right, take care, Sandra. It's always a joy. Bye now. Oh, I love those conversations. Oh, my goodness, would you look at all this? I hope some of these lights are still actually callers. Well, we'll find out in a minute. Somebody's got to be a caller. There we go. Hi, who have I got?
Bob.
Yeah.
Hey, this is Nick with Coal River.
Hey, Nick, how you doing?
Good, how are you?
I'm about to bust.
Oh, yeah. I heard you guys talking about the John Stewart video. I had to call up.
You saw it?
Oh, man, I just saw it this morning, and let me tell you, it's terribly funny. You know, I'm shocked and completely ashamed by the actual footage, but man, John just makes it so funny.
That video peeled me like a grape. It did.
Yeah, I couldn't help but watch
the last the last woman who says, and his name, I've had enough of Hussein's. And she's sitting there in her pink polka dotted muumuu. Agnes watched it with me, and they said, "What retirement home did they drag her out of to say that?"
No kidding, man. Oh my gosh, they find them, man. They find them to put them on TV, buddy.
And then we spend the rest of the, you know, we spend another decade trying to live that stuff down.
We do. You know, I'm so sick of people like digging for the West Virginia dirt, man, and pulling these people and putting them on camera, getting the people that are willing to go on camera and say stuff like that. I just don't know how they don't. I mean, you're living in 19.
You know what I call it, Nick? You know what I call it? I call it the Jerry Springer factor.
Oh God.
You know, you tune in Springer, and there's a whole bunch of just amazingly not with it people who are willing, women who are willing to take their shirts off for the camera in order to get some Mardi Gras beads.
Oh yeah.
Yeah. Well, this is that. I wonder, but I don't think it was very difficult. I wonder how much footage the people, the so-called journalists had to shoot of absolutely normal people saying, "Well, no, I voted for Mrs. Clinton because I really like Bill, and I've been voting for Clintons as long as there's been Clintons on the ballot, and I'm going to keep on voting for him." How many of those did they have to shoot before they got that woman who said, "You know, he wants to take the oath on the Koran."
Man.
But then you show that, and that's what becomes normal.
You know, it's so back and forth. I run into people on, you know, both sides of that spectrum, man, and it's so, you know, heartbreaking when it actually, you know, walks up to you and says hello, and you're just like, are you real? Are you even living in this year? Is this 2000?
I know you want to. Yeah, you want to reach out. Can I touch you? Am I hallucinating you? I want to see if you're really talking to me.
I'm serious, man. I'm glad we're talking about race issues, man, because I saw that video this morning, and I tell you, Bob, you know, it, like I said, you know, it was so funny, but at the same time, the stuff is just so tragic, and I can't help but every time I see somebody from West Virginia, because it's always, you know, bad PR, man. They're always putting bad PR. They you never see good stuff about West Virginia. The only thing good that I remember is the only stuff is even maybe positive. I don't know if I call it positive or not, but it's, you know, the primary. That was the only decent coverage I've seen of West Virginia in such a long time. You know, but I tell you, Bob, it's really been on my mind today because I saw that video, and then I tell you, it wasn't 20 minutes later, I walked right into a situation that just got me completely infuriated, man.
Oh, no, what?
Oh, yeah. Well, you know, I walked down out of the office and went down to the bank, cashed my check, right?
Yeah.
So I'm standing there, and another guy walks up, and, you know, the teller next to me, he's at her station, and they start talking about Obama, right? And, of course, you know, it just...
I don't even know if I want to hear the end of this story, Nick.
You probably don't. I mean, you know, after the gun mailer thing, man, I was just like... Oh, you know, I guess because of Obama's, you know, comparisons to JFK and things, that, you know, the whole...
You're sensitive to it.
They are. I mean, you know, I can't say that, you know, that gun mailer didn't spark things up for me, and I can't say that every single person that goes in office, I mean, you got to think now about that situation, you know, regardless. But, you know, the guy's standing there, and he's just saying, you know, well, you know, if he becomes our president, you know, I don't even know if you want me to tell the story on air, man.
Oh, yeah, go ahead. Yeah.
And he's like, well, you know, if he becomes our president and he gets assassinated, you know, that's what's going to happen. And I'm just like, oh, God. So I'm getting my money, and I'm going to walk out the door. And as I'm walking out, he's all like, and you know, when that happens, it's going to be, you know, a big race war. And let me tell you, I'm ready for when it happens. I got my guns ready. I'm like...
Yeah, because the race war is going to happen up the holler.
Yeah, right.
Or wait, is he going to go to the race war?
Yeah, you know, nah, he was you know, saying it like he was going to sit up in his shack and, you know, just wait on it to happen.
Yeah, sitting there like Sergeant York, licking the front of the site. Yeah, you got to pick them off from the back. They'll never know in the front. Oh, my God.
You know, and that happened like 20 minutes after I saw this video, and it's just, it's, you know, and I'm really vigilant of that sort of stuff, you know what I mean? Like, I, you know, my girlfriend, she happens to be, you know, mixed. She's more so a person of color than she, you know, most people assume. She's, you know, 100% African-American, but, you know, her father was mixed, and, you know, being down here in the valley, man, you know, mom, people come down here and they ask, you know, are there any, you know, African-Americans down here? And you know, we have fun because we're able to say, well, you know, the only ones you'll find is at my house.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? You know, we're proud of it too, buddy. Oh, man.
But see, the thing that's frustrating around here, Nick, is you get the sense that we're marching backwards.
Yeah.
Because we've been better than that. As I've noted before, the UMWA was the first union that was formed that was integrated from the very first day, because they recognized that everybody coming out of the mine was black.
Yeah.
And everybody that got sick from mining died a horrible, miserable death, and it was not with respect to race. So the labor movement that was influenced by the Highland School down in East Tennessee. All of that. The father of Black History Month was a Fayette County coal miner who went on to become a PhD professor who literally invented the idea of revering the contribution that African Americans have made to this culture.
Yeah.
And when you want to talk about those contributions, mercy, cooking, music, literature, visual arts, performing arts. Just about the entire... How many people are doing the minuet anymore? You know?
Yeah.
A lot of that old white culture didn't stick. But it was the honesty and the genuineness and the joy and the sadness that came out of the African-American experience that defined this culture. I mean, and that's why you've got stuck-up white people trying to pass laws in Florida saying that, you know, they're wearing their pants too low around their waist. You know, that's why the early rock and roll industry profited by what was referred to in white radio circles as that race music.
Yeah.
But God forbid that America should acknowledge that. Oh, we were founded on Christian principles. That's the thing that drives me nuts, Nick, because when you hear, it's all code. And I recognize racist code. When you hear some pasty-faced, doughy, fat preacher like Pastor Hagee talk about America being founded on Christian principles, what he's saying is that America was founded on, by God, white principles.
Yeah, no, that's so true, man. You know, I saw this great shirt, Bob. It said, ask the Native Americans about Christian love.
Yeah. Well, you know, one of our buddies down your way has a T-shirt that shows four Indians on horseback and says fighting terrorism since 1492.
Yep.
And I love that one.
That's a good one. I saw a great shirt that has the entire North American continent. It says Indian Territory.
Yeah. And how dare America even still have the concept of mixed race. Never mind the scientific principle that there's no such thing as race in the first place. Race is an ex post facto justification for separatist hate. But never mind that fact. I'm of mixed race. I'm English and Scottish.
Mm-hmm.
And those two people didn't like each other. But, you know, I've been a little bit of a smart aleck. But you got Irish Italians, and you got Polish English, and you got Jewish Greek. That's what the concept of the melting pot is all about. And we got people that are trying to, like I said, how is it that these people who have decided to hate Barack Obama
Yeah, no, you're right, Bob. No, you're right. That's another thing that really ticks me off too, is like, you know, he's, you guys are sitting here, you know, calling him, you know, just talking about him and saying he's, you know, he's only an African-American person, but hello, he happens to be of mixed descent. What happened to the part of Obama that was white, right?
Yeah.
What happened to that?
My personal theory is that it's more embarrassing to white people than if he was just fresh off the boat from Africa or something. Because then they could just engage, you know, they could just gear down into fifth gear racism and go for it. But you know, if you make them think about the fact that he, like they, I mean, look, I think about Tom Tancredo, you know, that racist bastard congressman from Colorado that was running for he was running for president for a while because he wanted to protect America against the Mexicans. Yeah, this is a guy whose last name is Tancredo, and that's not a Sioux or a Cree or an Apache or a Comanche word.
Right.
That's as Italian as it sounds, and his grandparents were the ones who got off the boat, and he's bitching about immigrants?
Yeah, exactly. Know your history, buddy.
Yeah. Oh. So, no, I'm... So, I mean, was there an upshot to what... the guy in the bank. Did you look at him and ask him what kind of ammunition he was going to use or anything?
Oh, man, you know, I was on my way out the door, Bob, and I would just... so heartbroken by what I'd seen already, and I just, oh man, I was just, oh Jesus, I was sick. I was sick to my stomach. I literally had to just go back to the office and then take a 10-minute to myself to kind of just breathe. You know what I mean?
Yeah. Well, let me ask you a question that gets asked of me, because I talk about all this stuff, and people know how much I love West Virginia. But then I talk about things like this. I'll ask you the question people ask me a lot. Why don't you leave? Why don't you go to civilization?
Why don't you leave? You know, Bob, I mean, I've done a lot of traveling in my day, and, you know, I wasn't originally born here. I was originally born in California, and, you know, and I feel like I have the desert and the mountains in my heart. You know, it's very much a part of who I am, both of them, you know, and West Virginia, you know, the slogan used to be wild and wonderful, right?
Mm-hmm.
And I'll tell you, Bob, I really believe that's true about West Virginia, man. It is wild and it is wonderful. You know, it's a strange and beautiful place. Almost heaven. I feel that way. I'm telling you, man. There's.
Yeah, and you and the rest of the gang are working to keep it from being almost level.
Yes, we are.
But no, I didn't ask that question of you from a smart ass standpoint,
no.
Nick.
No, not at all.
Yeah, somebody's got to
ask me.
Somebody's got to stand and fight.
Yeah,
we can't retreat forever. And where are, you know, when people say, you know, why don't you move, Bob? You know, where do they want me to go? What am I going to go somewhere and just insulate myself among a bunch of good liberals and live in some sort of little liberal paradise where I can pretend that the hate doesn't exist? Or am I better off standing up to the hate where I am?
Yeah, exactly. I mean, that's like saying, you know, why didn't we just ignore the Nazis? You know what I'm saying? It's something like, well, that, but also at the same time, you know, West Virginia is one of the most beautiful places anyone could ever be able to experience and be a part of, period. It really is. You know, there's a beauty here that is 100% unique, and you won't find anything like it anywhere else in the world. And that's a question that gets asked to us a lot, and I'll tell you, I've answered it quite a few times, and it really infuriates me, and here's why, you know, because the very thing that people who ask that question, you know, aren't doing is they aren't asking themselves that. They're not putting themselves in your shoes, you know. They're not thinking, well, if this came to me, you know. It's the same thing with mountaintop removal as it is with ignorance, you know, and that's what it is, ignorance. It's more unexposure than it is true bigotry, I think, personally. You know, it's a lack of real interaction. But, you know, it's like mountaintop removal, like where my home is right now. You know, they're trying to get a permit to do surface mining right behind my house. You know, and it's like people say, well, why don't you move? And I'm like, why should I have to move? You know, I didn't ask for this to happen to me. I didn't ask for this to be this way, you know. And you're asking me to, you know, in terms of, like, dealing with racism or things, you're asking me to, like, accept that and just, you know, go off somewhere and let it be. But that's not who I am, and I'm not going to let you force me out of the situation. I'm not going to let you oppress me from being me. You know what I mean? The same way with the mountaintop removal situation. You know, hell no, I'm not going to move. Why do I have to move? I didn't ask for the coal company to come in here and damage my land and my home and affect my history and my culture and my family and threaten my family home. I didn't ask for that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, no, hell no. No, and if the right attitudes stay here, and if we speak up, then maybe we change one attitude or two attitudes. Because, like I said to Sandra, if you start dividing fractions, you never get down to zero.
Yeah.
But you can work in the opposite direction, and you can drive the number up.
Yeah. Yeah. And it's like, you know, like I said, my girlfriend's mixed, but, you know, and it's like Sandra said, you know, everybody sees her as black. That's it. That's it, you know. And we're down here, you know, in the valley, and we'll walk into the local convenience store, and, you know, you'd think people just, I mean, you see literal shock on people's faces. That's unbelievable. And I'm like, do you not have a television set? You've never seen a black person before? What's your problem? You know what I mean? What is the problem? But it's simply, you know, it's a bit of
well, it's like that first woman that John Stewart played. Well, you know, we've had so many problems with them over the years.
Yeah, I'm like, what does that mean?
Where?
Yeah, what problems are you talking about?
You know, this is West Virginia. We don't have a Watts in the east end of Charleston.
I know, right? There's nobody burning down the courthouse. What are you talking about? You know, there's nobody, you know, there's none of the riots that we've seen in the history and other places that would give you any sort of indication or any other thing, not just riots, but any other situation that would justify that statement. You know, there was an artist that came down to the valley for a while named Francesco DeSantis, and he's the artist from the post-Katrina story portrait project. And what he does is he draws people's portraits with charcoal, and then you handwrite your story, and it's all like stories relevant to whatever he's doing. He's doing Appalachian, it's going to be called Voices of Appalachia, and it can be anything from, you know, the Stop Mountaintop Removal Movement to memories of Appalachia or experiences. Well, my girlfriend had her portrait drawn, and one of the things that she wrote about was the situation that I'm talking about now, like walking into our local gas station down here and having people just get shocked. And she had this great line. You know, it was just so unique. I never heard anybody say this before, but it was so funny. She was like, you know, people's expressions, you would think that they think I'm a hot pink polar bear or something. But really, if they took 2 seconds to, you know, just get to know me, they'd love me as a person. She's great, you know, and that's true. And, you know, it was a situation that we sort of, you know, it's something that is just like, wow, you know, we don't really worry about it, but then it's...
No, you don't worry about it, but the fact of the matter is you're on the front side of a battle.
Yeah.
And you know that.
And I told her, I was like, she gets kind of worried about it, and I was just like, you know what? We'll show them out of love, man. You know, don't even worry about them. They're not bothering us. They don't do anything. If they haven't seen it before, then guess what? They're going to see it now, and they're going to see that it's okay, and we're going to show them how, you know, love is supposed to be in this world between people.
Yeah, because the people who are marrying within their race have certainly got that divorce rate way down now, don't they?
Oh, yeah. They just hold the title on love, man, let me tell you.
Well, that's like the gay marriage thing coming out of California today. I saw some jokes here and there, you know, and I made a joke in the chat room about now that the sanctity of our marriage is threatened, Agnes is, I better go tell Agnes or something. I said it to Ed at the top of the program, you will never go broke underestimating the intelligence of the American voter.
Yeah.
Because they've already got the petition ready to go in California. The polling data suggests that something like 61% of Californians oppose letting people marry who they want to marry. And frankly...
Really?
Yeah, oh yeah.
Wow, man. That's kind of wild.
Yeah, and so this, you know, this election and this election season, you're going to hear it talked about in California. in conjunction with the presidential election. And let me tell you what you're going to hear, Nick. You're going to hear Republicans say, well, Barack Obama, he'll appoint activist judges just like the ones that let them get married.
Yeah, I see that coming, man. I really didn't mean to laugh, but that.
And it'll drag the racists and the bigots and the homophobes. Man, they won't crawl, they won't walk, they will wind sprint to the booth.
It'll be a film.
And if they get it on the November ballot, it's going to be trouble.
Man, I tell you, that whole calling Clinton the winner before 0% of the vote, you know what I mean? Like, and then the exit polls, people saying that they wouldn't even vote at all, you know, if Obama was president. Man, I just...
Well, see, I left a couple of them blank, but I didn't need to leave those blank.
No, definitely. Oh. I left a couple blank, too.
I took a... You know what? I got to tell you, I took a long, hard look, knowing what the outcome was going to be. I took a long, hard look at voting for John Edwards. Because he was my guy.
Yeah.
But in the end, I voted for Obama. Pardon?
What did you think about his endorsement?
It seemed... To me, it seemed ill-timed.
Yeah?
I think it could have had greater impact at a different part of the process.
Yeah.
Of course, I didn't agree with him getting out when he got out, because it was like he could have stayed in for Super Tuesday for free.
That's true.
But he bailed out ahead of time, and I still don't know why.
Yeah.
Well, Nick, I'm going to roll on. I love our conversations, though. Hang in there and, you know, just, I don't know, chew some bubble gum or something so that you won't grind your teeth the next time that you're at the bank and hear that kind of stuff.
Well, Bob, man, I just got to say, man, you know, she nailed it when she said McCain's wife boobs. I'm telling you.
Yeah.
Pass the Mardi Gras beads. No, I'm kidding.
All right.
All right, Bob.
Take it easy, Nick.
All right.
Bye. Oh, let's see, and we'll roll on. Nope, gone. Huh. Catching up with some email real quick. Our pal Cindy says, we have so many mixed families in my community that nobody notices anymore. The young people on purpose mixed it up to make their families get over it, and I'm talking about a couple of thousand couples. I say, bravo, vive la différence. Yeah, absolutely. She also says, crackers are the dumbest people on the planet. Strong argument to be made. Strong argument. So, by the way, just for the sake of curiosity, George Bush called... You know, all of us who think that we should talk before bombing, prefer with a goal toward not bombing, you know, we're appeasers. Looks like he's going to have to have a chat with his girlfriend Condi, because, among other things, she said she has urged some level of discussion, as has his Secretary of Defense, Robert Gates. And then, of course, dear leader goes over and says that peace is just around the corner. When Condi had said that peace in the Middle East is decades away. Of course, I'm also reminded that, Rumsfeld's not gone. He's still at the Pentagon, just laying low with a more quiet stance, not gone from government. He still works at the Pentagon. And looking back, I think, I think you're right. Because doesn't he have some sort of consulting job? Yeah. But we were, all of us who want to talk before bombing, we were called appeasers today. George Bush went offshore to take a cheap little tawdry catty dig at Barack Obama. Of course, that's the way the Bushes are. But of all the people to come out and bust somebody for it, how do you like it? Chris Matthews, Tweety, had this right-wing gas bag named Kevin James. Where they found him? What? I don't. How do you do this? What do I got to do to get on opposite Tweety? I guess I got to get on the terrestrial radio, you know, the real radio, instead of this medium that has the potential to reach, you know, the entire world. But they turned over some rock and they found this pasty-faced dude named Kevin James, who came on to talk about what a sickening appeaser Barack Obama is. And he was on with Tweety for 5 minutes. And Tweety asked him over and over and over again what it is that Neville Chamberlain did. Just asking him for a basic fact. Guess what? Right-wing gasbag Kevin James couldn't come up with an answer. Here you go.
I want to do a little history check on you, because the president's referring to history. He attacked those who would imitate Senator William Boer of Idaho, who was a Republican isolationist back in the late 30s, who supported whatever, some notion of getting along with Hitler better. Let me ask you, what did Chamberlain do wrong, Neville Chamberlain do wrong in 1939? What did he do wrong?
It all goes back to appeasement.
No, what did he do? Tell me what he did.
It's the key term.
You have to answer this question.
He goes,
what did he do?
It's the same thing. It puts it all...
Well, tell me what he did.
About appeasement.
What did Chamberlain do wrong?
His actions enabled...
What did Chamberlain...
You hear this? You know what this reminds me of? This reminds me of an episode of the Andy Griffith Show, when Andy is trying to get Barney to explain to Opie, because he knows that Barney doesn't know, trying to get Barney to explain to Opie what the Emancipation Proclamation was. Did you hear that?
What did Chamberlain do wrong, Neville Chamberlain do wrong in 1939? What did he do wrong?
It all goes back to appeasement.
No, what did he do? Tell me what he did.
It's the key term.
It's the key term. It's the key term. Well, Barney, what was the Emancipation Proclamation? Well, Ange, it was a proclamation of emancipation. Yeah, Barn, but what did it... Well, it emancipated, Ange, you know that. And that other episode where he was pressing him on the Punic War. Well, who fought in the Punic Wars? Barn? Well, Ange, everybody knows that the Punics did. Ladies and gentlemen, Kevin James.
Answer this question.
He goes,
what did he do?
Goes, it's the same thing. It puts it all. It's,
well, tell
it's
me what
talking
he did.
About appeasement.
And, what did Chamberlain do wrong?
His actions enabled, energized, legitimized.
No,
it's the exact. It's
Kevin,
the exact same.
I'm not going to continue with this interview,
Chris,
unless you answer what that thing is. What did Chamberlain do in 39? Tell me,
Chris. It's the exact same thing.
What
right?
did he do? What did he do?
This is pathetic. What did he do? For once, poor little Tweety's getting it right. What did he do? What did he do in 1939? I mean, his name wasn't Neville Appeaser Chamberlain. He did something.
What, 38, 39, Chris? What year
what
do you want?
Do?
It doesn't. It's the exact
ask,
same thing that happened, Chris.
What did Chamberlain...
Nice necktie, nice blue shirt, big old thick neck, good haircut, empty head.
He's talking about appeasement.
All right.
Well, it was a proclamation, Ange, of emancipation. He's talking about impeachment.
What did Chamberlain
Chris,
do?
Appeasement.
Just tell me what he did, Kevin. What did Chamberlain do you didn't like?
Look.
What did he do?
What Chamberlain did... what Chamberlain did that I what the president was talking about? You just said the president was talking about Barack. Look, they
I want you to tell me, Mr. You're making a reference to the days before our involvement in World War II when the war in Europe began. I want you to tell me, as an expert, what did Chamberlain do wrong?
Look, you're not going to box me in here, Chris. President Bush was making that. I'm glad the president, of course, Neville Chamberlain, he was an appeaser, Chris. He was an appeaser, and it energized and it legitimized. Kevin James, what did Neville Chamberlain do?
Chris, may I try to answer?
He doesn't know.
Chris,
you
can I answer?
You are BSing me. You are talking about a very critical point in American history and European history, and you can't tell me what Neville Chamberlain did at Munich. What did he do in 38?
Chris. I wasn't the one that raised the Hitler comment. My point is, what President Bush has done is he has taken the shot across
the
bow.
You don't know what you're talking about, Kevin.
No, what do you mean, I don't know what I'm talking about?
Tell me what Chamberlain did wrong.
Neville Chamberlain was an appeaser, Chris.
Jesus! Holy cow! What did he do? What did he do wrong?
He was an appeaser.
Who did he appease?
Well, he was an appeaser.
You know what? This guy is the audio version of the guy standing in the photograph with the poster that says Morans. Really? That thing made the guy with the Morans sign is the poster child of right-wing intellectualism. This guy is the audio version. What'd he do wrong? He's an appeaser! That's all he had. He had the word appeasement out of George Bush's speech where he committed political treason against the United States of America before the Knesset today. And that's all he had. Hey, he was an appeaser! I know what happened in Munich. You know what happened in Munich. You know and I know why Neville Chamberlain has become a name for being put upon. But see, we're too smart for terrestrial radio. You're too smart a listener, I'm too smart a host. Because the terrestrial radio audience that is largely sought after by right-wing controlled radio ownership in this country only wants people who can spit out idiotic, babblesome talking points and never actually get to any content or substance. You know, it all would have ended with poor Tweety there. It all would have ended if the little freak had just said one word, Czechoslovakia. Just one word. Yeah, it's the Czech Republic and the Slovakia, but back then it was Czechoslovakia. And Neville Chamberlain negotiated away their freedom at Munich.
Neville Chamberlain was an appeaser, all right?
What did he do?
Neville Chamberlain, his policies, the things that Neville Chamberlain supported, all right, energized, legitimized, and made it...
And poor Mark Green's on the bottom of the screen down here having an aneurysm. I mean, he's having a baby. Kevin James, your right-wing poster child for dumber than a box of rocks.
Easier for Hitler to advance in the ways that he advanced.
What?
Easier for Hitler to advance in the ways that he advanced. Oh, the war was fought between the Punics, Ange. Let's go to the phones real quick. Hi, who have I got?
Hey, Bob, this is Albert.
Hey, Albert.
That was beautiful. That was a beautiful piece of radio right there.
Come on, the Andy Griffith analogy is spot on, isn't it?
Oh, you know, this is exactly why I called you. You're doing the Andy Griffin, and all I could see was, Mr. President, what's your definition of the American Indian and their sovereign issues? And da 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 da. What does that mean to you? Well, you're sovereign means you're sovereign.
dude.
You're sovereign. It means you're sovereign entities. It's like Idiocracy with electrolytes. It's got what plants crave.
Yeah, plants crave it. It's got electrolytes. Why? It's what plants crave. Well, why does it have electrolytes? Because plants crave it.
What are electrolytes? It's what plants crave.
Oh, we watched that the other night. It just destroyed. I've seen that movie 5 times now, and it destroys me every time.
I love that movie. That was the most, but, you know, and that's the thing. I'll tell you what. I see that moment in that movie. Not only that, he's got that, right? But I don't know if you ever watched The Kids in the Hall. My wife and I.
Oh, yeah. I'm squeezing your head.
Do you remember the skit where he called he was a factory worker, and he calls him in to say, listen, you're saying the word, what was the word? Ascertain. You say the word ascertain too much. He's like, but no other word fits. Ascertain. I ascertain this. I ascertain. Anyway, it goes off. And basically, it's just like he knows one word. Oh, he appeased. He's an appeaser because he appeased and let Hitler do what Hitler wanted to feel like going and stuff.
I like creamed appease with those little tiny pearl onions.
I mean, this is just brutal. And, you know, you're right. It's all right if you're a Republican.
Yeah.
You know?
You can have an IQ smaller than my shoe size, and there's somebody out there that will pay you $1 million to slither in behind a microphone every day. Jesus, I'm in the wrong business, Albert.
No, you know what? I'll tell you what. Today was a strange day, and it was since the very moment I opened my eyes. And, I mean, I saw some clips. I couldn't even listen to audio. It was too early. And I saw some clips of Bush and Israel grabbing a cup and
got stumped by a cup.
What is that? What?
But, you know,
I mean, and then
the reason I could never make the $1 million and be a conservative talk radio host, Albert, is because I just can't keep up that level of stupidity long enough and that kind of lying. On the other hand, I offer you Ehud Olmert. These are his words, okay? Quote on George Bush. He is a great leader, a great friend, a source of inspiration. How do you do that and not have a little bit of vomit in the back of your throat?
That's like, you know, this is our between the lines here. I mean, this is the between the lines that the Russians had to, because they had to deal with propaganda so badly that they had to, you know, they knew the truth just by reading the lies. And you know what this is. You know what this is. You know why Joe Lieberman jumps off and is like, oh, Bush said the right thing, la la la. You know why he does that.
You know what? I think it's about time that a picture, the body of Glenda the Good Witch of the South, be superimposed under, you know, under Joe Lieberman's neck every time in that little bubble floating along. Ooh, he said the right thing.
Oh God, he's just the most. He almost makes me believe in David Icke when he's talking about reptilians.
Oh God.
I know. But hey. I don't, but I could see with him, it's tough not to see it. It's just
And the beautiful thing about this clip is it goes on and on and on, and finally Matthew says, I've been sitting here 5 minutes asking you to say what the president was referring to in 1938 at Munich. And Kevin James finally goes, I don't know. And Matthew says,
they don't know.
You don't know.
They don't
Thank you.
No, they know two sentences that they're told to say, and they say it the same exact way, two different ways. It's just, I mean, it's every time. That's all they say. That's why they all sound the same. They still say the same exact words. I'm telling you, they must wake up and they have their, you know, morning coffee and they jump up and sing and clap. I mean, they get all.
And you know, the word of the day today was appeasement. You know, it's just like something off of Sesame Street. Today's word is appeasement.
Yeah. You know, whoever pulls the biggest heist gets the, you know, the bowl of stack of bills. How much do these people make to say this crap? Listen to the general. These people we're supposed to trust, and they're talking about, oh yeah, we should already have been attacking Iran because they're all them IEDs are made from there. And then did you see? Oh no, these IEDs, our military says, nope, they're not made in Iran.
Damn.
So we should be already...
I know.
Going to war?
But then again, they, you know, we're supposed to trust these generals. These are the guys who approved the purchase of $1,000 toilet seats.
Right.
Yeah, see? Right. Hey, Albert, we're out of time, brother. Got to roll.
All right, brother.
All right, talk to you later. Thanks.
You too. Bye-bye.
Bye. Hey, we ended on a giggle. I like when that happens. Up next, a Just Us version of Strictly Confidential. With your host, the world's most fabulous LGBT conversation radio host, Peter Godbold. Also coming up, the horn section at roughly 11 p.m., followed by the end-of-the-week version, end-of-the-week edition of All Foxed Up, because it's already Friday in Australia. Wow, does that create tempting scenarios for me. But never mind. That's all on the way. Thanks to Ben Birch, the hardest-working man in liberal talk. The man who almost single-handedly saved and created liberal talk on the internet at whiterosesociety.org. Abundant and a multitude of thanks to the hardest-working, bravest people I know, the folks at Coal River Mountain Watch, crmw.net. You can be part of the solution by joining Coal River Mountain Watch, and you'll feel good about it. And always, 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 RMR. Gina, it's all for you.